Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to talk about, the state of manufacturing in the country. I'm going to talk about the state of manufacturing around the world. Also, you know, we see all these tragedies going on across the globe in countries that manufacture our goods. You look at the last one in Bangladesh where the building collapses. Again, you know, this whole zoning and regulation. No, can't have that business. They'll take care of themselves. As they crush hundreds of workers and have these mass tragedies. Is there anything that we can do? What can we do to influence to stop that, since our government doesn't seem to have the stomach for it? Since our trade policies encourage this kind of bad behavior, these kind of bad actors, is there anything that we can do? Well, we're going to talk a little bit later about a situation where, you know what, some college students did. Also, we're going to talk about more education activists, I mean parents, in the streets fighting for their kids' futures and fighting the austerity brought on by the Tom Corbetts of the world and Republicans and their Democratic lackeys. Also going to talk about the historic day that was in the Pennsylvania General Assembly, as the number of anti-equality legislators have dwindled, and the people who believe in the Constitution, well, they grow. Yeah, that whole equal protection thing under the law, you know, that's a little thing. And you know, just oh, you meant for those people? Oh, wow. You know, the Constitution, I thought it was only good for me. Yeah. We'll talk about that, and also more anti-worker, no rights at work legislation moving its way through the federal system. Because, hey, you know, you've got all these rights, you workers. We need to break them down and make them weaker. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Before we get into all of that, something is just really, really driving me freaking insane. Something has come across my radar that has me just, again, you see these attacks and you expect them from Republicans. You expect them from the party of multinational special interest. You expect that. Remember last week we talked about the layoffs in the Department of Labor and Industry here in the state? There's going to be about 100 people being kicked to the curb, you know, by the more jobs governor. The guy who calls himself the more jobs governor, who continues to fail at creating, more jobs. I shouldn't say that. He has created more jobs than Wyoming. So I guess we're the more than Wyoming. He's the more jobs than Wyoming governor. So we can qualify that to make it accurate. 1,000 jobs in the private sector he's created in the last year. His policies have created in the last year. Just a thought, just a note, if you think about it. But something came across my radar and caught my attention, because there's some legislative language right now being floated, an amendment being floated, that's going to take $10 million from the unemployment compensation insurance system that workers pay in, the workers' side of it. So you know how every time you get your paycheck, you see workers' unemployment compensation, every dollar that you make, there's a percentage that goes to pay for that insurance policy, that in case, hey, you get kicked to the curb, the job's taken from you through no fault of your own, you get to collect a couple of bucks to help you put food on the table and sustain so you can find something else. It's insurance now. Understand, you pay for it. Not the part of it that the employers pay, which you look at it and just, what a sham. The General Assembly, another screw job for workers, but that's a whole other debate, another argument for another day. But in this example, you've got a Democrat, the chairman of the committee, Mr. Keller, who, from what I'm told, is floating this idea of taking $10 million from the employee side of the unemployment compensation insurance and putting it towards paying for administrative costs at a time when we laid off 100 workers. Now, as I'm seeing this, there's no language saying we're going to call those workers back and we're going to use this $10 million to make sure that those workers have jobs. There's none of that yet. Maybe there is. Maybe there's an excuse for this, and I'm looking into it as we speak. But I'm looking at this scenario going, okay, we laid off 100 workers. You're going to take $10 million from the employee side of unemployment and put it into administrative costs. And you know this administration's not going to go, oh, hey, let's call those workers back. You see this as an opportunity to privatize. Oh, we can have one of these entities that, of course, is going to give me some campaign cash. We're going to have one of these for-profit groups. They're going to administer all this stuff because the private sector does it so much better, so much more efficient. That's what we're told. Kind of BS, but still what we're told and what some believe. So we're going to dole out this $10 million to, the way I see it, to this private company to administer the unemployment compensation insurance plan that we, for ourselves, have put together, that we used to do for ourselves, that now has to come with a profit motive. And I see this as one of those moments where the system, Democrats, a Democrat and the Republicans, are robbing workers to fire them to give campaign cash to politicians. I mean, how much more devious can you get? That's saying, okay, we're going to fire these 100 workers. They're going to probably end up on unemployment. And then, and this is the beauty of this, and you got to love the symmetry. You got to love the design. You got to love how this all comes together, because now those people who lost their jobs collecting other people's unemployment information, they're going to have to go to someone else who took their job in the private sector for probably half the pay and no benefits and no pension. And they're going to have to go to them to file for unemployment so that we could take that money from those workers who paid into it on every dime that they earned, give it to Corbett and the administration. And you know they've already proven to us that, you know, it's the profit market that our money will go to. And it's just another privatization scheme. And this is one of those moments, in my view, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I've been thinking a lot about the NRA and the model that they've created. And maybe it's not a bad model. I wish people, and I said this I've said this a couple of times, but last night a lot, that I wish that working people would view their health care the same way my gun nut friends hold their guns and their bullets. That we would fight for our pensions the same way that the gun enthusiasts fight for radical people to have arsenals. I wish that we would fight for our and wage laws that protected our paychecks in much the same way that the gun industry protects their right to sell to children. I mean, stop and think about what kind of a work environment we would have here if we had millions of people who were willing to, at the drop of a hat, say, you know what, we're going to fold our arms and we're not doing a damn thing until healthcare is solved, till workers' pensions are secure, to working conditions that are safe, where you don't have an environment where you blow a 93-foot hole in the earth because, oh, you thought you could break the law and you didn't have to report it and you were doing all of these things that you knew. I mean, somebody knew. Was it probably illegal? I mean, what if we had an environment, a work society that thought that way? And that when they saw something like that happened in Bangladesh or happens in China or happens in Vietnam or happens in any of these developing countries around the world where their workers are killed in mass numbers, where they're injured and thrown away, that we really woke up and realized that an injury to one worker in this world is an injury to all of us. Because once you start that cutthroat competition, that free falling to the bottom, it pulls us all down. And I love the neoliberals who tell me, well, you know, Rick, it's important that we put those factories in those developing countries and they have to go through the growing that we went through, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers killed every year, millions injured, because the profit is sacrosanct and we got to make that profit so we can have cheap goods. So, you know, their lives are expendable for our cheap clothing. Even though we find out that it would have cost no more than 10 cents per garment to make sure that those workers worked in a safe environment and at a reasonable wage. 10 cents per shirt. And you go, who wouldn't pay 10 cents? Well, evidently my neoliberal friends. the same people in this country, like Papa John, who said, oh, it's going to raise the cost of a pizza 11 cents, which is a BS number. If I have to provide health care for my workers, how dare the government tell me I have to do that? 11 cents. How many people wouldn't pay 11 cents extra for a pizza? They'd probably pay 11 cents extra for the profit, I know. But at the end of this, it goes to me, I wish people were more militant about how they support their family, how they keep their family healthy and fed and clothed and housed. I wish there was more militancy around that. Instead of what I see, and what's infuriating to me on so many levels, is the wealth class in this country has done a beautiful job of getting us, pitting us against one another. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. You see, today, the stock market, the Dow closed above 15,000. Above 15,000. On the same day that the governor of Pennsylvania says we're going to steal pensions from future generations. On the same day that he said, you know, we're going to rebalance. I love that word. We're going to rebalance the pension funds. By giving the future generation 401ks that Wall Street can steal from them. I mean, think about that for a second. And did we see a spontaneous uprising of every worker in this Commonwealth? Did we see the next generation go ballistic? No, because we've been lulled to sleep. And we've been over-misinformed by a media culture that, hey, it's all about the next shiny thing. Hey, look over here at this freaky-looking person. That's focus on that. Instead of talking about what's really important, which is you and me and other working people getting screwed in the worst way while the CEOs and the executives and the institutional investors are walking away with massive money, your money, the money that you worked for, the wealth that you created. That's been concentrated at the top. I know, Rick, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. You're damn right I am. Work should mean something. Work should pay, don't you think? What happened to my personal responsibility? What happened to my you know, fair days work for fair days pay people? Oh, they don't exist, do they? Because we're too busy fighting about abortion and gay marriage and guns and all of the other stuff that they keep as wedge issues to keep us pitted against one another. And I'm hoping there's a day that we go back to where my grandparents' generation was. Well, we can disagree on those things, and we can disagree about religion and whatever. But at the end of the day, our paychecks, that was what was important. And that's what the working class understood, and that's what collectively they came together and fought for. An honest way to make a living. And safe conditions with reasonable wages and some security when they get older, instead of what the Republicans are moving us towards, which is a destruction of what few weak labor laws we have, a destruction of retirement security, destruction of health security, a destruction, a systematic dismantling of all of the safety nets and all of the structures put in place by past generations to make sure that their children had a better tomorrow. This generation of Republicans are making my kids' lives less secure, less prosperous, and less healthy. And yet, we keep hearing we want more austerity from the GOP party. Nonsense. What we want is we want to share in the wealth that we create. And I'm hoping at some point we wake up and realize there's only so much of you know what we're willing to eat, and we've hit that point. And it's time to take to the streets. It's time to take to the halls of legislative, of general assemblies and legislatures across the country and D.C. And average everyday people like you and me saying no more. That's my hope. Now take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit about Bangladesh. Going to talk a little bit about what we can do. Quick break. Right back.
Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union Local 8 members are locked out of their jobs at the Port of Portland, Oregon by Columbia Grain. ILWU Local 8 President Bruce Holt says the Japanese-owned company has hired an out-of-state strike-breaking firm, anti-union lawyers, and a publicist to make allegations against local workers. Port of Portland security guards, represented by ILWU Local 28, also say they have been improperly displaced by the lockout. This latest port lockout of West Coast dock workers follows the Port of Vancouver, Washington lockout by Matsui-owned United Grain that started February 27th. United Grain and Columbia Grain are part of an employer bargaining group trying to squeeze dock workers. The ILWU says rather than bargain to reach fair contracts, the employers are locking out their workers. Republican legislative leaders in Ohio said just hours after some Republicans introduced anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation that there's not enough support in the GOP-controlled General Assembly to pass the anti-union bills. Three separate bills proposing anti-union right-to-work policies were introduced on May Day by Republican Representatives Christina Rugner and Ron Magg. In 2011, in a landslide statewide vote, Ohio voters resoundedly repealed the anti-union attack on public worker collective bargaining known as SB 5. Construction workers in Coopersville, Michigan, protested the use of non-local workers at the construction site of a state and local subsidized project. Jesse Russell reports.
Fair Oak Farm Brands has contracted Dahlgren Industries to build their $127 million bottling plant. In order to build the plant, the company received state and local grants. A protest held on Friday was intended to bring attention to the company's use of non-local workers and also the firing of two employees, reportedly for expressing interest in joining a union. The protest was led by the West Michigan Plumbers, Pipefitters, and Service Trades Local 174. According to the union, the company has brought in workers from other states, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines for the project. The two pipe fitters fired by the company have filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. The company has responded to the allegations, saying that 90% of the workforce is made up of Michigan residents and that the workers were terminated for violating safety and work rules.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We now have more than 2,500 survivors who have been rescued by our rescuers, by our forces who have been working in this area relentlessly for over all these nights, throughout nights and days.
We need a movement that defies every kind of inequality. One that empowers the poor and the poor. One led by both women and men.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So you look at this factory collapse in Bangladesh that has claimed somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 lives now. We talked last week, the number was over 400. Now you're talking upwards of 700 people killed. 700 people who went to work trying to support their families like all of us do didn't come home. Why? Well, building codes. An employer that knew the building was unsafe, that you saw cracks in the building, created this environment, and then said, go in or you're gonna lose your job. So the question then became, how much would it have cost each of us the consumers? Because understand most of those garments ended up here or in Europe, in developed worlds, in the Western world. According to the Workers' Rights Consortium, according to their answering that question, it would cost us about 10 cents. Per article of clothing. 10 cents. That's it. But it's too much according to the industry. Can't compete. 10 cents a garment can't compete. So we can't have safe work conditions. So the question then becomes, how do we as consumers, if our government's not going to do it, how are we going to do it? So when I saw this story and I heard about what happened at Penn State, I said, I gotta talk to someone about what they did with Adidas. So I've asked Paul Clark, professor and head of the Department of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Penn State University, to come talk to us. Paul, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, hi, Rick.
You know, I look at this horrible tragedy. Some 700 people lost their lives because this factory collapsed. And it's, in my view, poor zoning regulations, poor construction regulations, poor inspections, and really no oversight. But here you have this scenario that leaves me going, how do I make sure that I'm not contributing to that?
Well, yeah, I think that's a great question. And I know in our classes here at Penn State, we talk to students about this, and you know, most of them are not aware that the vast majority, if not virtually all, of our clothing now is made outside the United States, and in many cases made in sweatshops. And you know, unfortunately, there's just one incident after another, like the one we've seen in Bangladesh. There have been fires in Bangladesh. There have been other disasters. So this is a problem that just keeps going on and on. And we do have a group of students here at Penn State, a student group called United Students Against Sweatshops. And they're doing a great job of getting the word out about these kind of problems.
And so what, you know, one of the things I've often said, and you know, I've had this this kind of running discussion with some of my friends who are alum of Penn State, saying that, you know, we should have large organizations like Penn State, the state of Pennsylvania, the federal government, all of these different entities, these large buying agencies, saying we're not going to purchase items made in sweatshops or places that don't give workers rights or allow them to join unions and collectively bargain, that we shouldn't be spending our tax dollars and our money in those kind of places. So I heard a story about Adidas, and I thought, you know, this is an interesting situation. Can you explain what happened?
Well, yeah. First of all, as I mentioned, we've had a group at Penn State called United Students Against Sweatshops for almost 10 years now, and they've been doing a great job of trying to inform the university community about the problems in apparel workplaces overseas. And because Penn State is such a big brand and is such a popular brand, it has some leverage over the companies that make their products, that make Penn State products, that want to license Penn State shirts and sweatshirts and apparel. And so there's been a movement around the country to get universities to put pressure on these apparel companies to make sure that university apparel is not made in sweatshop conditions. And at Penn State, the students about 8 years ago got the university to join the Workers' Rights Consortium, the group that you just mentioned. It is a independent group that that inspects apparel factories all around the world. But they wanted the university to go further and support something called a designated supplier program, which would have gone much, much further to ensure that Penn State apparel was made in factories that respected workers' rights. The former president, Graham Spanier, wouldn't budge on the issue, but the students kept after the university year after year after year. Well, we have a new president at Penn State, as you may know, President Erickson, and we have a situation where there's been a campaign about problems with Adidas suppliers in Indonesia. What happened was that one of these suppliers closed down a big factory with 2,600 workers. And in Indonesia, there's a law that when you close a factory, you owe the workers severance pay. Well, the supplier who makes the products for Adidas refused to do that. And Adidas claimed that they had no responsibility since they had subcontracted the work. So United Students Against Sweatshops started a national campaign here to force Adidas to pay the severance pay that the workers were owed.
I mean, that's a small – and where did it end up? Did they end up getting the severance pay?
Well, one by one, universities around the country began to sign on to the boycott and to suspend their contracts with Adidas. I think Notre Dame did it. There were about 15 universities, but aside from Notre Dame, none as big as Penn State. So our students went to the administration, presented all the evidence. The administration didn't take action right away. The students then brought, at their own expense, a couple workers from the Indonesian factory to do a tour of universities in the U.S. and talk about the problem. They came to Penn State. We had a sellout crowd in an auditorium where these workers told about the conditions and the impact that the losing their jobs had on their families, and the fact that they didn't receive severance, you know, had really put them in desperate straits. The students went back to President Erickson. President Erickson listened to them. They provided evidence. He took all of the evidence under consideration. And just a day or two after meeting with the students, he announced that Penn State was suspending its contract with Adidas and would give them 60 days. And if they didn't resolve the severance issue, they would cancel the contract with Adidas. Penn State, being a big university, seemed to be the university that sort of pushed, created enough momentum that Adidas paid attention. And within about 3 weeks, Adidas agreed to pay several million dollars in severance pay. And incidentally, just today, Penn State reversed the suspension because Adidas has done the right thing.
So, I mean, that's a wonderful win for those workers, just to get the severance and just for the company to hold its end of just the law that they have in those countries. But at the end of this, you know, shouldn't we be talking on a much grander scale, a much bigger scale of using the buying power of Penn State and Notre Dame and all of these big universities in the state and the federal government to lift people's conditions up and saying, you know, that we're not going to allow sweatshop conditions and poverty wages and all of these horrible things that we see across the country, and maybe even start talking about domestic consumption and production here, so that workers in this country have the ability to have some of those jobs for domestic consumption.
Yeah, and I would certainly agree with that, but it's taken a terrible, terrible tragedy like the one in Bangladesh, I think, to finally get a significant amount of the public to start thinking about these issues. And, you know, I am encouraged that that people seem to be paying attention now, and that there seems to be more and more people who are saying, you know, just because these pieces of apparel are cheap doesn't mean that we don't have any obligation to the workers there, and that we shouldn't take into effect or take into account the fact that the death of workers, like we've seen in Bangladesh, is a cost that comes with this cheap apparel. And, you know, maybe the moment will pass, but there seems to be more momentum than we've ever had to try to get these companies to meet their responsibilities.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You keep saying cheap apparel. I got to be honest with you. I've seen Penn State's T-shirts, and I've seen college athletic wear, and I've seen the NBA and the NFL and all of this stuff, and all of it. It's not cheap. You know, it's not. You know, the reality is that somebody's making serious money off of this, and it's not the workers. And I have a huge problem with that.
Well, it's absolutely true. I've seen some breakdowns recently of the various costs that add up to total the price of, let's say, a Penn State sweatshirt, and the labor cost is very, very small. It's, you know, it's 3-4%. The profit margins, though, are huge.
Yep.
And so, you know, that profit, if it was even cut a little bit, you could sell the apparel at the same price and pay workers a decent wage and make sure that they aren't dying in factory collapse, you know, in incidents like we see in Bangladesh. It wouldn't take much, just a little less greed on the part of the companies. They make lots of money as it is.
And that's my problem with our trade policies, and that's our problem with the direction that, we've allowed business schools to teach students. You know, when I first went through, you know, through college years and years ago, you know, that this whole trade thing was just starting, and we weren't pushed in the idea of, hey, cheapest production, that's the way to go. I actually learned a little responsibility to the community and to the economy as a whole, and now it's, hey, whose throat can we cut for pennies? It seems to be the way that things are going on.
Well, and yeah, I just think that it's sort of out of sight, out of mind when folks go to Walmart or some other place and buy, you know, apparel that's very cheap. You know, people just don't start to think about you know, why is this so cheap? How can you make a piece of apparel halfway around the world and sell it, you know, for such an inexpensive price? And the reason is, we're doing this on the backs of workers in other countries. We're putting them at risk. We'd never think about letting our family members work in a place like that. We'd never think about letting a factory like that, operate in our community. But it's easy to put it out of mind when it's done in Bangladesh or El Salvador or Vietnam. It's hard to ignore this latest tragedy. People, right. You know, it's right there on the front page, and we all have some responsibility for it.
I agree, but you know, here's the thing, and maybe I don't totally agree with that we don't have those conditions here. I mean, you see people dying on the job every day here in this country, something like 13 a day. You see horrible tragedies like in West Texas. You see working conditions that are sliding backwards. You're seeing, you know, people who are shopping at Walmart because they tell me I can't afford anything else because my wages are falling backwards. Our conditions are falling backwards. So as we allow these conditions in Bangladesh and Vietnam and China and all around the world to be in these just deplorable situations, it's pulling us down as well.
No, it's people use the term race to the bottom, and you know, that's clearly what's going on. And, you know, when workers make, well, it's pretty clear, Rick, you know, we have a global economy now. And,
but we've always had a global economy, Professor. It's always been a global economy. It's just that we did things a little differently and said, you know, we're going to have tariffs to protect our workers and to protect our local economy from cutthroat competition. At least that's my thought. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, no, we always have had some international trade, but you know, I think the economy is globalized to an extent that it hasn't been in the past, and you know, the fact that workers in other countries have to work at such low wages means that they can't really join the rest of the world as consumers, and you know, if they were to make better wages, or better still, if the jobs were back home here, where workers could earn a decent wage and then go back and be consumers. You know, I always bring up the idea of Henry Ford. You know, Henry Ford used to pay his workers back in the early 1900s when they were making the Model T more money than he had to, and capitalists thought that was a terrible thing, and they asked him, why are you paying such good wages? And he says, I want my workers to make enough money that they can buy a Model T. I'm creating consumers for my own product.
Yeah, this was not his benevolence. This was not out of goodness of his heart. He was a capitalist. He wanted to sell more stuff.
It was a good strategy. It was good business sense to make sure that workers had enough money to buy products. And, you know, the high point of our middle class in this country was in the 50s and 60s, when unions were much stronger, when workers made decent wages and could go out and buy refrigerators and cars. And by doing that, they created more demand for the products, which meant that the companies were making a lot of money and had to add more workers. And again, they were more consumers, and we had an economy that wasn't a race to the bottom. It was more of a race to the top. But we've tossed that out of the window in pursuit of low wages nowadays. And I think, you know, the instability of the economy in the last 10 years or so is clearly one of the payoffs of this.
Yeah. Let me ask you the last question I've got for you, because, you know, I talk to a number of people who say, you know, that's a horrible tragedy. What can I do? So when I go to the local, I haven't been to Walmart in about 16 years, but when someone goes to the local Walmart or the local big box retailer, because they're all basically the same in my view. So when they go there and they see these products on the shelf, what are they supposed to do? Because it's my view that this whole idea that there's a product made in China and a product made in Japan and a product made in the U.S. all right there for the consumer to choose from is malarkey. It doesn't exist. It's not there, because the American product most often is taken off the shelves and hidden somewhere else. So your choice is between bad and, in some cases, worse. What are consumers supposed to do?
Well, I mean, that's a really tough question, because there aren't enough alternatives. But there are some. There's a company decided to take a different approach. It's called Knight Apparel. And it manufactures apparel in, I believe it's Haiti, or no, it's El Salvador. But they decided to try an experiment. They went down there, opened a new factory, paid wages that were three times the average wage in the apparel industry in El Salvador. I'm sorry, in the Dominican Republic. I've got that wrong. It's the Dominican Republic. So now there's Penn State Apparel made in this model facility in the Dominican Republic. It's sold in the Penn State bookstore. The workers there make great wages. They work decent hours. And the price of the apparel is about the same, if or maybe 10 cents, 15 cents more. So at least in that one instance, this company has provided an alternative for people who want to buy products from a responsible company. There's a few of those companies out there, but there's not enough. You won't find them on Walmart shelf. But I think we're going to see a demand for this kind of ethically made products in the future. And so the only thing consumers can really do is pay attention and learn about these products that are ethically made. That's a first step.
And it's one of those that I've been saying for the longest time. We've got to know where things are made. And for me, it's by union, then by American. Because, you know, a lot of the situations in this country are kind of questionable in my mind as well. Anyway, Professor Clark, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the information. Thanks for the update. I look forward to talking to you again.
Sure. Good to talk with you, Rick.
Thanks so much, Professor Clark. He is the head of the Department of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Penn State University. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm going with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Ask me, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Sometimes corporate greed flares with such intensity that it ignites public outrage. This happened in April when an 8-story, recklessly built clothing factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh, crashed. Hundreds of workers were crushed by slabs of concrete, having been ordered by the ruthless factory owner to continue working, even though the structure's collapse was imminent. Public rage at such scorn for the value of workers' lives led to mass protests across the country and the jailing of the owner. Good. But what about his equally culpable cohorts? the CEOs of Walmart, Gap, and other retailing behemoths who've instilled this culture of greed throughout their global supply chain. They've dictated a corporate order that compels shortcuts on safety and rewards unscrupulous factory owners. Walmart and other major clothing marketers surged into Bangladesh in recent years specifically because it has the world's cheapest, least protected laborers. Corporate bosses know that Bangladeshi factories are hell holes where nightmares constantly come true. Less than 6 months ago, a horrific fire in another factory in this same city killed 112 workers who were making clothing for these same giants. Walmart subsequently responded by pledging zero tolerance for such haphazard manufacturing, loudly launching a $1.6 million worker safety academy in Bangladesh, and blah, blah, blah. It was pure, disgraceful PR bull stuff, and it changed nothing. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, Walmart refuses to sign a legally binding fire and building safety agreement put forth by labor advocates. It would require the profiteers to make all their factories safe, open each one to independent inspectors, and stop their senseless tolerance for the serial killing of garment workers. For information on this agreement, go to workersrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a Republican.
And he loves cheap clothing. Loves cheap clothing. And you look at this and you go, I've been saying for years that the universities and these big entities, and I remember right after the collapse, Obama took office, and there was this huge hiring for the census. And I think I still have the hat and the mug somewhere that they were giving out at one of the conferences I went to. And the hat and the mug were made in China. And you go, are you kidding me? With the U.S. Census label on it. And you go, the whole idea of the stimulus at the time was to get people back to work. And, you know, I called and I talked to people. And you know, the rationale was, well, there are no manufacturers in the U.S. anymore that could do the large numbers that we needed. And I remember being just completely struck by that. That we've allowed our manufacturing base to dwindle to the point you just can't do it. We've given it all away. We've given that manufacturing prowess away. And for what? We didn't get cheap goods. I mean, it's not cheap toasters anymore. It's not cheap T-shirts. Have you seen the price of this stuff? It's not cheap anymore. It's just higher profits. And I think the professor laid that out pretty well. And, you know, for me, you know, the argument that the right makes is that, well, you know, we want to compete with those other companies and they should be on the same shelf next to each other, so I have the choice. You show me where that happens, because it doesn't. You know, when I go to the Home Depot or I go to Lowe's or the big box store and I'm looking for something made here. First and foremost, you can't find it. And then I've got to make the choices between bad and less bad. And to me, I look at this and I go, you know, this is where you need policymakers. This is where we as a militant working class need to say, hey, you've given our jobs away enough through bad policy. Time to put your foot down. Yeah, because I was thinking as the professor was talking, you know, how many of those college kids are taking out massive loans because their parents can't afford it because there are no jobs here? And how would those textile mill jobs be a good second job for a family? And I think back to, you know, some people that I've known through my lives who, you know, their mothers worked in the local textile mills here in Pennsylvania, you know, during the school day because the employers, hey, you had to deal with the labor you got because you had to be local. Now you get these situations where these people work in sweatshop conditions 12, 15, 16 hours a day and still can't make enough to survive or buy the product that they're making. And that's the problem here. When you're working your butt off and you can't afford what you're making, there's a serious, serious problem with the pay scale. just is what it is. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around here. This is another Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
In a part of the ocean known as the North Pacific Gyre, plastic waste has increased 100-fold over the past 40 years, according to a new study.
This is the infamous Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's not an actual floating island of garbage, but it is a part of the Pacific filled with floating bits of plastic, often fingernail-sized, mostly from the U.S. West Coast and East Coast of Asia.
Miriam Goldstein of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego led the new study. It indicates that the plastic in the North Pacific Gyre has provided new habitats for some marine creatures. Which sea creatures are being affected? One is the marine insect known as the sea skater or water strider. They're related to the water skaters you might have seen on the surfaces of freshwater ponds.
Marine sea skaters live on the ocean surface. They lay their eggs on floating objects such as seashells, seabird feathers, tar lumps, and pumice, and now plastic garbage, according to Goldstein's study.
The increase in plastics for skater habitats could result in more marine sea skaters. This in turn can create a subtle shift in the ocean food web. Goldstein's study was published in the journal Biology Letters.
For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Pacific Plastic. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us, because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
Inequality, I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world.
Yes, what a wonderful rural world. Education was privatized and profitized, and the Bloombergs and the Gates of the world could pocket a whole ton of money, and the DeVosses. And, you know, school was just for the well-to-do and those poor kids. Put them back to work in the factories, and we could have conditions like in Bangladesh. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Kind of look back to our history, and that's where we came from. But heaven forbid we teach our children where our country came from. And, you know, I look at today, National Thank a Teacher Day. And to be honest, I think every day should be National Thank a Teacher Day, because if you can write, if you can read, if you have the ability to do a little critical thinking, I know that's being eviscerated from the schools, but yeah, if you have that, a teacher helped along the way and inspired and changed lives, at least in my case. And I'm sure in most people that I've talked to, the same thing. And I look at this situation in really all across the country, but in Michigan, where austerity has cut funding for public education, and the school district of Buena Vista, Michigan, They're going to lay off all of their teachers at the end of the year because they don't have enough money to finish the year off. And the teachers, being the teachers that they are, the people who care about kids, will work for free. Don't lay anybody off. Let's finish the year. We'll take care of it. The school district said, no, not going to do it. We're laying you all off. Think about that. It's all about the money, folks. It's not about the kids, and it never has been, which is why I've been saying for the longest time, we need parents to get out in the street. We need people to say, no more. We're going to stand up. We're going to fight for our kids. We're going to fight for their opportunity, which is why when I saw this story in Allentown, I just thought, got to get somebody to talk about it. And I've got the organizer of some 150 people out in the street protesting and screaming about the budget cuts and the cuts to the school. So I've asked Yahira Ivia Washington, one of the organizers, to come and talk to us about what she did in her local area. Yahira, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Thank you for your support and your time.
You know, I see all of these cuts to education opportunities. I see all of this funding cut, $1 billion each of the last 2 years our governor has taken out. And you heard the legislator woman there at the beginning saying, oh, well, we took it out, but we put it all back. All the money's there. It's not, but they want us to believe it is. But you look at all these cuts, and, like, we're going to sit down and take it. And I got to tell you, good for you for standing up and saying no more.
Thank you.
So explain to me how you did it. Explain to me why you were out in the streets. Tell me what.
Okay. Well, my husband and I, we have five children, three of which are currently in the Allentown School District. Allentown has been our home. We are both products from the Allentown School District as well. And, you know, we've slowly seen the school system deteriorate over the last few years. To the point where it's really affecting our children. And when we heard of the proposed cuts, 144 teachers losing their jobs, you know, we were having a conversation one night, and we just were brainstorming on what we could possibly do to try to change this or bring awareness to parents or do something to make a change. And, you know, my husband said, well, you know, 1 year when we were in high school, there was something like this pretty similar that was going on, and we walked out of school, and we protested in front of the administration building. And that sparked everything. That started the movement, and just the phenomenal outcome we had yesterday.
Yeah, I saw what was upwards of 200 people showed up to protest these cuts, and you hear people say, well, they're protesters and activists, and you're damn right, they're parents, they care about their kids, they care about the future, right?
That's right, and it is their right, it is their obligation, and they should be commended for doing that.
And I do, I give you the absolute credit, because I've been saying for the longest time, look, it may not be happening in your school district right now. The massive cuts and the massive slashing of programs and opportunity may not be happening today, but it's coming. What we saw last year in the Chester Upland School District, a couple of months the teachers didn't get paid. What you're seeing in Buena Vista, Michigan, in Allentown, it's all part of the model that's coming to school districts across this Commonwealth. And the goal is to profitize and privatize education so that kids like yours and kids like mine, they don't get the shots that you and I had.
That's right. And it's the same. It's our children's future, and we must take a stand. Not only must we take a stand, but we have to make sure we keep ourselves informed. The Allentown School District does a very poor job of keeping the parents informed of what is going on. The Hispanic and African-American population are the majority in the school district. And the way the Allentown School District makes their information public is at their board meetings. These are meetings that start at 7 o'clock at night and go on to 11, 12 o'clock at night. And, you know, for people like me with families, a husband and children that are in school,
yep,
it's very hard to make it to these meetings.
Well,
and
they plan on you not being able to attend.
Absolutely. So they take advantage of that, and they don't publicize the information and make sure that the parents are 100% aware of what is going on. And that's probably the biggest crime, because not only are they cheating the students and the children, they're cheating the parents, and they're keeping us from our rights. We should know what is going on with our children at all times.
So let me ask you this. You got some 200 people to show up. I mean, I've tried to organize a couple. When my daughter went to kindergarten, they told me there were going to be 30 kids in her kindergarten class, maybe upwards of 33. I said, look, there's not enough room in the classroom for the kids to trip over each other, let alone learn anything. I tried to get parents to be outraged, and it was impossible in my view. How did you do it?
It took a lot of legwork. It took a lot of speaking, and a lot of teamwork. You know, my mom, my sister, family, friends, you know, a friend of mine, Teresa, Stephanie, so many people said, this is a problem and we have to do something. And word of mouth, Facebook, flyers, FedEx helped so much with discounts and free flyers. And it was just amazing. And Allentown has such a horrible stigma for, you know, crime and the education. But it's comprised of citizens that truly do care about our city and have good hearts and are willing to go the extra mile. And if given the opportunity, can really create phenomenal things for our city.
So let me ask you this. Who, in looking at the situation, because we hear a lot of talk about, you know, who's to blame. And a lot of the people that I know point the finger at the people who are least to blame, which is the teachers, in my view. When you have a situation where we have a governor who's basically systematically dismantling public education and defunding it before our very eyes, they blame the teachers. So I'm curious, as you were talking to people, where do you see the problems? How do we fix? What's the solution? How do we go forward to make sure that my kids, your kids, all the kids in this Commonwealth have an opportunity to get a good quality education and a public education?
I think we would need to start with replacing Governor Tom Corbett.
I'm with you on that.
I'm sorry?
I'm with you on that one.
Absolutely. The cuts, you know, are coming from him. And, you know, they stream down to our children eventually, which are the most effective. But with his cuts, you know, he has the whole privatization for the liquor, state liquor licenses and things like that, which to me is just a bunch of garble. But we need to replace him.
We need to get that money back into the classroom. We need to get teachers the support that they need and invest in education, because it's going to have a positive return down the road, unquestioning. So my last question for you, you know, is this the end of it? I mean, did you get the outcome you wanted, or is this just the beginning of moving forward?
This is just the beginning. I don't know what the outcome has been yet. I know that we were heard. I know that we were felt, and I know that we cannot be denied. I'm hoping to hear what we achieved as a group very soon, and I'm sure I will hear something very soon. But no, it is just the first of many different things to come.
Outstanding. Yahira, I appreciate
number one.
Yahira, I appreciate the time. As you move down this road, would you keep us informed? Because we would love to come down and cover your whatever you do next. Because I think this is a model that we have to pay attention to, and the parents around this state have to maybe look to do it in their own school districts.
I most definitely will. We need more supporters like you, and I thank you for what you do, helping to keep our people informed. Very important.
No, thank you, Yahira. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union Local 8 members are locked out of their jobs at the Port of Portland, Oregon by Columbia Grain. ILWU Local 8 President Bruce Holt says the Japanese-owned company has hired an out-of-state strike-breaking firm, anti-union lawyers, and a publicist to make allegations against local workers. Port of Portland security guards, represented by ILWU Local 28, also say they have been improperly displaced by the lockout. This latest port lockout of West Coast dock workers follows the Port of Vancouver, Washington lockout by Matsui-owned United Grain that started February 27th. United Grain and Columbia Grain are part of an employer bargaining group trying to squeeze dock workers. The ILWU says rather than bargain to reach fair contracts, the employers are locking out their workers. Republican legislative leaders in Ohio said just hours after some Republicans introduced anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation that there's not enough support in the GOP-controlled General Assembly to pass the anti-union bills. Three separate bills proposing anti-union right-to-work policies were introduced on May Day by Republican Representatives Christina Rugner and Ron Magg. In 2011, in a landslide statewide vote, Ohio voters resoundingly repealed the anti-union attack on public worker collective bargaining known as SB 5. Construction workers in Coopersville, Michigan, protested the use of non-local workers at the construction site of a state and local subsidized project. Jesse Russell reports.
Fair Oak Farm Brands has contracted Dahlgren Industries to build their $127 million bottling plant. In order to build the plant, the company received state and local grants. A protest held on Friday was intended to bring attention to the company's use of non-local workers and also the firing of two employees, reportedly for expressing interest in joining a union. The protest was led by the West Michigan Plumbers, Pipefitters, and Service Trades Local 174. According to the union, the company has brought in workers from other states, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines for the project. The two pipe fitters fired by the company have filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. The company has responded to the allegations, saying that 90% of the workforce is made up of Michigan residents and that the workers were terminated for violating safety and work rules.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America.
The Rick Smith Show.
Some good news, perhaps someone actually doing their job in the Pennsylvania General Assembly, as the Senate Transportation Committee today approved Senate Bill 1. The idea is, hey, our roads and bridges are crumbling, guys. You think we should do something about it? It's only been a couple of years since we've really done it. Maybe we should come to work today and just do a little something. Just a thought. Maybe. Anyway, the Transportation Chairman, John Rafferty, Republican from the Berks County area, said the plan that he has come up with would raise about $2.5 billion that they would put into repairing our crumbling roads, bridges, mass transit, airports, and ports across the Commonwealth. Here to talk to us about the plan, good, bad, indifferent, whatever, our good friend Abe Amoros from the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA. He's their Pennsylvania Legislative Director. Abe, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick. It's good to be with you.
So Senate Bill 1 approved. So this should sail right through. The money should be, what, a week, 2 weeks? People back to work, you know, in a month? What?
I wish it were that simple, Rick, but as you said earlier, the bill did sail through the Transportation Committee today by a vote of 13 to 1, and it does have 28 co-sponsors. So obviously this is going to be a priority for the state Senate, and we're hoping that there's going to be a vote in June. Now, we only have a few days left.
June?
That's what the chairman of the Transportation Committee is pushing for. Now, there are going to be 15 session days in June, and of course what what I'm hearing, Rick, is that they're going to take up the budget first and then tackle the transportation bill for the end of the session.
Oh,
of
well.
Course, that could change to, you know, in a heartbeat.
So July then? August?
Well,
because they haven't knew it, because, hey, we didn't know the budget was due at the end of June. Who would have known that? Who would have possibly known the budget was due at the end of June? We
exactly.
probably should have been, we could have been working on it for the last couple of months.
Well,
like we could have been working on the transportation. No.
Absolutely, Rick. You know, you and I both know, and the listeners know, that there are sometimes misplaced priorities in Harrisburg. And we're left holding this bill, $2.5 billion. And we're forced to be happy about it now because nothing has been done for the last X amount of months. Now, naturally, we wanted something done last year. In fact, we wanted something done 2 years ago when that Transportation Funding Advisory Commission was formed and came out with its report. And then we were a little bit fluxed to learn that the governor's proposal was less than what the report actually recommended. And so now we're back to applauding $2.5 billion annually. And, of course, we know that the need is anywhere between $4 and $5 billion. So something has to be done, clearly, and we're hoping that it gets done in June. Now, Rick, as you know, the construction season is here now. And, you know, every day that goes by is a wasted day without the necessary investments in our infrastructure and, more importantly, putting our people back to work again. That's what this is all about, is putting our people back to work again.
Yeah, I mean, July, August, I'm thinking about this, and I'm going, you know, what the hell were you waiting for? I mean,
yeah.
What other priorities, Abe, were there? What other priorities than passing the budget, fixing our roads and bridges, doing the simple work of governing and making sure that people's lives are semi-reasonable? What possibly could be more important? Oh, I know. Pass a resolution, 2012, the year of the Bible. Hey, that's helpful. How about
that's
stealing
right.
collective bargaining rights from cops and firefighters, the people we call heroes? Yeah, let's go after and attack them. Let's attack teachers and let's
right.
destroy you unemployment cop. Yeah, those are really good things, don't you think? I mean, creates jobs, right?
They have wasted so much time and energy on things that are just not important to the people of Pennsylvania, that it really just, I mean, you sit and it makes your head spin. And you become more cynical as the days go on. You know, when the legislature is in session, they really ought to be putting their heads together on how to create jobs that will not only put people back to work, but will fix our crumbling infrastructure, will help communities become more sustainable, and just improve the living conditions of everybody. I mean, union and non-union workers. But they don't get it. They don't see it that way. What they do is they wait till the last minute to do the heavy lifting, and then they get maybe half or one-third of what they really need. And it is frustrating. There's no question about it, because somewhere along the line, our system just came to a grinding halt and started misprioritizing. I mean, look. They spent all this time on the privatization of the state stores. They're not going to do anything until the fall, if at all, Rick, if at all. And now they're going to talk about pension reform. They're probably not going to get to that either. What they really ought to be focusing on is what everybody's talking about. And they're agreeing, at least in concept, that something has to be done on transportation funding. So let's stop messing around and let's put this thing to a vote. Send it to the House and have it done as quickly as possible, as quickly as possible. It's a 97-page bill, Rick. I was pouring through it today. Senate Bill 1 is a 97-page bill. And the thing that I've been asking every single legislator, including the leadership that put this thing forward, is does it have any anti-prevailing wage language in it? Because if it does, it is going to be DOA dead on arrival as far as we're concerned, and we're going to unequivocally pull our support. Thankfully, there's no language in that bill that is anti-prevailing wage. So they're going to leave our wages alone and put our people back to work. But right now what we need is strong leadership in the Senate that says, okay, this has to be priority number one, and we'll get to other issues later. And, again, what I'm hearing is that they want to do the budget first, get that out of the way. And, you know, I could just see another late night, Rick. I could just see it. pulling the plug at 11 o'clock or 11:01 p.m., you know?
Yeah.
And by law, you can't really pass anything, you know, after 11 o'clock anymore. So here we go again, playing the waiting game and hoping for the best. And it's really no way to run a railroad.
Let me ask you this, Abe, because, you know, as I look at this, the cynical part of me says that, well, you know, we're going to hold off. They're going to miss this construction season. The money will be allocated. There'll be additional money next year so that the beginning of construction season next year, obviously an election year, will be red hot. People will be back to work. And the thought being that, you know, hey, the more jobs, Governor, because I don't know if you've seen, our governor is now, you know, calling himself the more jobs governor, even though in the last year the private sector's only created 1,000 new jobs. And I'll correct that he's the more jobs governor more than Wyoming, yes. Everybody else, no. But there's part of me, the cynical part, Abe, that goes, you know, next spring when all of this hits and people are back to work, and he can then turn and say, hey, look, I'm the more jobs governor.
Well, there's no question that politics is clearly involved in all of this decision-making. I'm hoping that the legislature preempts any of that nonsense with the governor, because I wouldn't put this past him at all. In fact, that guy needs a victory more than anybody I've ever seen sitting in that office at this point, at this time of year, going into an election. And I wouldn't put it past him. But again, Rick, I just don't think that he and his people are that smart, that savvy, that Machiavellian. I'm really hoping that there's some champions and some heroes in the state Senate that will push this thing along and then influence those members in the House that say, we don't want any tax increases. And, you know, you sit and you talk to some of these Republican members, and you would think that reality just escapes them. I mean, for every day that goes by, the cost gets higher and higher.
Yep.
So we have to act now. But to them, oh, absolutely not. We can't go for any kind of tax increases. That's going to hurt the public. Well, what's hurting the public now is inaction. What's hurting unemployed workers is inaction. And what's hurting everyday commuters is inaction. I mean, you can see it in the urban areas. You can see it in the outer suburban areas. You can see it in the rural communities. No one is immune from bad, crappy roads and despicable bridges that are crumbling before our eyes. Nobody's immune to it yet. I don't know. The light hasn't gone on yet.
I keep saying it's going to take the governor and his motorcade to get swallowed up by one of the many sinkholes here in Harrisburg on his way back to the mansion over on Front Street, and maybe that's what it's going to take.
Well, I'm hoping that it won't be that dramatic, but let me tell you, Rick, this guy really needs a dose of cold water poured all over him in order to wake up, because he has not seen the light. And many of his own colleagues, Republican colleagues in the House, have not seen it either. Again, I'm glad that it's starting in the Senate, because this transportation chairman has at least been able to come across as reasonable. He is reasonable, as a matter of fact. I mean, I've sat with him on several occasions. And this is the right thing for Pennsylvania. We've got to push this through, and it's got to happen. And the longer we wait, the more we miss out on that construction season. And the longer our folks are on the bench, not working, not providing for their families, and hurting themselves, and ultimately hurting the economy of every community in Pennsylvania.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning on the funding of this. You know, I saw Daryl Metcalf, or Mad Cow as we call him, I saw him say that we should sell the liquor stores and use the money from the liquor stores to pay for our roads. And don't give it to education, because that's just a black hole. That education, the black hole, just wasted money. We should put it into roads and bridges, because nothing says roads and bridges like alcohol. And you know, that's an image I want put together. I like the idea of drinking and driving, and let's make a sport out of it, I guess, again.
Fortunately, that idea has become a non-starter in the Capitol, and I think it's a silly idea, and one with really nasty undertones as well. I mean, what he's really saying is, why don't we pit one union against the other and see what happens? Let's roll the dice and let's forget about education, because, you know, putting money into public schools and strengthening teachers and strengthening the education of our children, that's not important. That's not important either. That's not top priority. So, you know, let's say the hell with the kids and the teachers. I mean, but, you know, it's insidious. It's narrow-minded. It just goes to show the intellectual and moral bankruptcy that we face sometimes in Pennsylvania. where the legislators who have a seat at the table are just not strong leaders, and they're not the visionaries, and they don't want to invest, they don't want to spend a dime, they don't want to raise any taxes for things that have to be done because infrastructure has to be done in Pennsylvania, or else what we are flirting with is a disaster. Yeah. And then everybody's going to come out of the woodwork pointing fingers and no more solutions. And that's not what it should take in Pennsylvania.
I agree. And you look at this, and the narrow self-interest of I didn't raise your taxes is going to turn around and bite him in the behind if a bridge collapses and you see a bunch of people killed because of it.
That's exactly right, Rick.
But again, you know, this is one of those things that used to be nonpartisan. It used to just get done. And I'm sad to hear that you don't think it's going to be till June, July, possibly even August. It's just completely dumb to me. Abe, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you.
Likewise, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Abe Amoros from the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Sometimes corporate greed flares with such intensity that it ignites public outrage. This happened in April when an 8-story, recklessly built clothing factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh, crashed. Hundreds of workers were crushed by slabs of concrete, having been ordered by the ruthless factory owner to continue working, even though the structure's collapse was imminent. Public rage at such scorn for the value of workers' lives led to mass protests across the country and the jailing of the owner. Good. But what about his equally culpable cohorts? The CEOs of Walmart, Gap, and other retailing behemoths who've instilled this culture of greed throughout their global supply chain. They've dictated a corporate order that compels shortcuts on safety and rewards unscrupulous factory owners. Walmart and other major clothing marketers surged into Bangladesh in recent years specifically because it has the world's cheapest, least protected laborers. Corporate bosses know that Bangladeshi factories are hell holes where nightmares constantly come true. Less than 6 months ago, a horrific fire in another factory in this same city killed 112 workers who were making clothing for these same giants. Walmart subsequently responded by pledging zero tolerance for such haphazard manufacturing, loudly launching a $1.6 million worker safety academy in Bangladesh, and blah, blah, blah. It was pure, disgraceful PR bull stuff, and it changed nothing. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, Walmart refuses to sign a legally binding fire and building safety agreement put forth by labor advocates. It would require the profiteers to make all their factories safe, open each one to independent inspectors, and stop their senseless tolerance for the serial killing of garment workers. For information on this agreement, go to workersrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
there are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me, because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go, go. I messed up my entire life because I got high. I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what?
Now I'm sleeping on the sidewalk and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, because I got high. Because I got high.
Again, policy had nothing to do with it. The fact that the economy collapsed had nothing to do with it. The millions of jobs lost had nothing to do with it. No, it's because you were a drug addict and lazy and stupid. Yeah, I mean, and look, when the right can't explain their failed policies, when they try to defend bad decisions and saying, oh, the banks learned their lesson during the Depression. They would never do the kind of things that they did back then. They've learned. They're advanced. They care. They'll police themselves. They don't believe that there's a culture of us bailing them out year crisis after crisis. No. That's just it's lazy people. It's those people who wanted loans because they took out too much. It's their fault. It's not the system. No. The banking industry is just fine. And I love how the right does this. I love how the wealth class does this kind of stuff to us and divides us. Now, it's those unemployed, they're unemployed, not because the jobs went away because of bad trade deals or because you had a collapse or any of that stuff. No. It's because people are lazy and stupid. And, you know, when they can't explain away their bad economic policy, which is that the free market is a cutthroat situation where jobs and the society are not in the equation. It's all about pure profit. It's about me, and everybody else be damned. When they can't explain that away, they have to attack. And what you're really seeing is, and we've been talking about this for a while, the fight between the Milton Friedman mentality of the unabashed laissez-faire free market and, you know, the Keynes worldview, which is when you have a massive collapse like we did, that you spend money to prime pump to get the economy going again. Seems rational and lucid to most people I talk to and most people I know, but the right, they haven't figured out how to really push back on it because it's common sense. But I like this Harvard historian, this Niall Ferguson, who is one of the top historians in the world, or was. And it appears to me, and I've been thinking this for a while, that this is a guy who's really been bought and paid for pretty well. The wealth class keeps him well-heeled. They keep him well-funded by giving big speeches. And one of the latest speeches he gave was at the 10th annual Altergius conference in Carlsbad, California. And it's for, you know, financial advisors and big investors. It's a big deal for the upper crust. The people who deal with huge amounts of money. And he was talking about, you know, Obama. He was talking about the stimulus and the New Deal and this idea that, you know, we need to fund programs to get the economy going, get people jobs, be, you know, government employer of the last resort, which I completely agree with. He didn't seem to believe it. And not based on, you know, here's fact, but by asking the audience how many children John Maynard Keynes had. I mean, think about this for a second. You're not actually anymore arguing the validity of his theory of priming the pump and deficit spending to get the economy moving, then paying the debt off in years to come when the economy heats up from the activity. Because once you get it kickstarted, it gets moving. And we saw this during the Clinton years. And then you start paying it back. Because if you remember at the end of the Clinton years, they were worried, Greenspan was worried, I don't know what we're going to do. We're going to be debt-free. Have no idea what a debt-free world looks like. Well, Bush fixed that. The Bush policies and the giveaways to the top 1% completely fixed that one. But here, Niall Ferguson is talking to these financial advisors and these big investors saying, well, how many kids did Keynes have? Oh, he didn't have any. Why? Because he was gay. And, you know, trying to explain this idea that he didn't care about the future because he didn't have any children. He didn't care about the country because or the Globe because he didn't have any children to pass it out to is ludicrous on a number of levels. Because you think about somebody who thinks in legacy terms that he's going to be remembered for generations. You kind of want to think in terms of how's it going to work. But that's the thing aside. Keynes was actually married. And he talks about this, and he says that he was married to a ballerina whom he likely talked of poetry rather than procreation, which is not quite accurate according to some of the reports that I've read. In fact, his wife had miscarriage with their child. And I look at this, and I go, you know, how low and how despicable can you be? Now, he's apologized. He's come out and apologized, well, in one of those half-hearted apology things. But I look at this, and you gotta think, how low, how deprived can these people possibly be? Because they don't have an answer for the theory. They don't have a lucid argument against it, because it makes perfect sense. If the private sector isn't going to step up and create jobs that we want them to, somebody has to. Because as we learn, when you have oversupply, when you have mass surpluses and no one buying those things, you generally end up having more layoffs. And you have a spiraling downward. So as you have more supply of things and more supply of labor, the wages go down, the ability to buy products goes down, and you have this spiraling downward. You need to have someone to come in to prop up demand, to prop up production, and to get people back to work so that the system starts moving again. And as the thing goes, prime the pump, get the pump moving again. But in the Ferguson world, it doesn't work, not because he makes the argument that it's bad policy, but because the guy was gay. Or he was bisexual, as some people are going to say. And here again, I don't care. But it's more of this gay bashing. And what I find interesting, on a day like today, when you had a record number of state legislatures here in Pennsylvania who sponsored a bill, House Bill 300 and Senate Bill 300, that would ban discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, actually had 102 sponsors, 77 in the House, 25 in the Senate. That you had this happen today seems kind of interesting to me. Because I don't think you should be allowed to be fired for being gay or transgender or anything. But I don't think you should be able to be fired for just any reason whatsoever. Now, for me, this non-discrimination bill, I don't know what kind of teeth it's going to have. Because the reality is you don't need a reason. So now this is just one more thing that the employer can't say while he's firing you. Instead of saying, well, I don't like you because you're gay, I'm saying, well, I don't like you because you're wearing blue shoes today. That's perfectly legal. So don't say old, don't say race, don't say gay, don't say any of that. But, you know, blue shoes, not fond of. That's perfectly legal. And for me, there's a lot more to talk about in terms of labor law and reforms that we need going forward. The other part of this is there was a piece of legislation introduced today, the gay marriage ban to the state constitution, that had the lowest number of co-sponsors ever to put a constitutional amendment up to ban marriage between man, woman, marriage. Only 27 representatives co-sponsored the man, woman bill, which is, I think, pretty remarkable that we've seen this shift. And for me, it's about the Constitution, and I'm a firm believer in that Constitution, equal protection under the law. We are all equal. Just a thought. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's kicking up the sand. It's blowing out a message to every woman, child, and man. Yes, a mighty wind's a-blowing across the land and across the sea. It's blowing peace and freedom. It's blowing equality. Yes, it's blowing peace and freedom. It's
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth, sky.
In a part of the ocean known as the North Pacific Gyre, plastic waste has increased 100-fold over the past 40 years, according to a new study.
This is the infamous Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's not an actual floating island of garbage, but it is a part of the Pacific filled with floating bits of plastic, often fingernail-sized, mostly from the U.S. West Coast and East Coast of Asia.
Miriam Goldstein of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego led the new study. It indicates that the plastic in the North Pacific Gyre has provided new habitats for some marine creatures. Which sea creatures are being affected? One is the marine insect known as the sea skater or water strider. They're related to the water skaters you might have seen on the surfaces of freshwater ponds.
Marine sea skaters live on the ocean's surface. They lay their eggs on floating objects such as seashells, seabird feathers, tar lumps, and pumice, and now plastic garbage, according to Goldstein's study.
The increase in plastics for skater habitats could result in more marine sea skaters. This in turn can create a subtle shift in the ocean food web. Goldstein's study was published in the journal Biology Letters.
For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Pacific Plastic. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We're sending you a message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Paul, the late Paul Weyrich, one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation, you know, the pioneers of this moneyed structure to change our government, to change, well, our ability to vote. I mean, as you heard him say right there, you know, if we can hold that vote down, we can win. Pretty much the Corbett plan, the Bush plan, well, the Romney plan, the Republican plan. And where's all this coming from? Coming from the big moneyed interests. And, you know, as we talked about the last couple of weeks, you've got a sitting junior U.S. senator here from Pennsylvania pimping for funding for the Tea Party think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, from those very same people. Well, we've got the guy who wrote the book on the right-wing money machine. He's written the book The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. He's also one of the Alec Eight's most wanted, Lee Fong, our good friend. Lee, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, good to be here. How are you?
I am good. You know, I look at this, and I, you know, looking through your book, you go, this is just, it's one of those things where you go, is it that open? Is it that blatant? Are the people who have this kind of money, are they doing this, really this much in the open?
Well, it depends how you describe the word open. You know, they're not hiding that they're trying to take over the country, that they're trying to push this really radical agenda of unwinding entitlements, of slashing taxes on the wealthy and increasing sales taxes and fees on the working class, on, you know, rolling back financial regulations. They're open about that, but the way they're doing it, the actual methods, the way they move around the money, that's very opaque. That's not so transparent.
Yeah, because I keep asking the, you know, the Commonwealth Foundation and all of these, this infrastructure being built here in Pennsylvania, I keep asking, where's that money coming from? And they, well, we don't have to tell you, but we all know. We know where the money comes from, don't we?
Well, yes and no. You know, I think it's very telling that the Commonwealth Foundation rents its office space from one of the biggest lobbying trade groups in Pennsylvania. So that tells you a lot right there. But like you said, yeah, they don't disclose their donors. You're able to track a little bit of this money because you know the nonprofit laws in this country are such that, you know, if you're a foundation, you've got to report all the money that goes out. But if you're a nonprofit like a 501c3, you don't need to report any of the money coming in. So if you find the right foundations, you know, the Koch brother foundations, what have you, you can track a little bit of the money. But you know, I think the fact that the Commonwealth Foundation is literally situated in the offices of the Pennsylvania manufacturers, and they're working closely with these types of lobbyists for the big businesses in that state. That tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, I like the fact that, and what's kind of angering to me is we've got a sitting U.S. senator who's begging for money to destroy workers. I mean, this whole Project Goliath thing, its main goal is to destroy workers and their ability to have a decent wage and to have a pension and some retirement security. And they're pretty wide open about it.
Well, you know, in states like Wisconsin and Michigan, where they've done similar things, you know, they went out there and lied to people. They said, oh, you know, this isn't about unions. We respect the union folks in our state. We've just got to deal with this budget deficit. Oh, we've got to deal with the kind of future, pension costs for the state. You know, oh, we've got to deal with all these kind of structural problems that, you know, might increase taxes down the road. You know, they use all these kind of rhetorical and tricks and these types of distractions to fool people so they don't think that the real agenda from these right-wing Republicans is to decimate labor unions, to gut the labor movement. But at least in the Commonwealth Foundation in Pennsylvania, they sent out that fundraising letter where they're very open about it. They're saying, let's slay the unions. Let's take them out. So, you know, not that this is a positive development, but at least they're being candid.
Yeah, it shows how far we've now gone down that road. Because I remember in 2011, in February, when we were in Wisconsin broadcasting from in the Capitol and sleeping on the floor there, I remember saying, look, the reason we're here, the reason this is important is because it's coming our way. And when we went to Ohio and said, hey, you know, this is coming our way. And when we talked to people in Michigan, hey, this is coming to Pennsylvania. Be prepared for it. Well, here we are now. It's come to Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I got to give you and your producer, Brett, big props because you've been in the trenches. You've been watching this thing. You've been monitoring. You've been reporting on this movement by billionaires and their allies. And their corporate allies is really just decimate labor unions all throughout the Midwest and around the Great Lakes. And I think just informing folks, going out and explaining to people what's really going on is incredibly important. Because if you look at what happened in Wisconsin and in Michigan, and to a lesser degree in Indiana and Ohio, I mean, there are complete sneak attacks. You know, I think the public wasn't ready for it, and even the progressive kind of constituency groups weren't ready for it. So that's maybe one difference in Pennsylvania that you guys are out there talking about it.
Yeah, but I look at this, and you know, I've been saying since the beginning that this is not just unique to those states. This is a national plan, a national strategy. The playbook is just being handed around, and here it is now. And at the time, you know, when you talked about the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, people go, "Well, who's that?" One of these shadowy, secretive groups. Now they're out front, and in my view, you look at when they dumped all of their model legislation out, saying, here's our stuff. This is what we're pushing. They feel emboldened to now say in public the things, the radical things they've been whispering to each other, much like here in Pennsylvania with Project Goliath.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, ALEC is just one spoke in the wheel. There's so many groups now. And the book kind of goes through this, that, you know, after 2008, when Republicans saw themselves out of power for the first time in 30 years, you know, Democrats had the majority of governorships, a progressive majority in the House, and majority in the Senate that wasn't reliant on these Dixiecrats, and of course a progressive president, or at least a president who promised a lot of progressive things on the campaign trail, Republicans had a freakout moment, and they went to the states. They started just funneling millions of dollars into these state-based think tanks and to prop up these types of groups that have really shifted the balance of power. And I think it's very likely that they'll go after Pennsylvania next, because I don't think this is bluster. You know, this is part of their long-term agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, the book called The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, written by our friend Lee Fong. If you want a copy of it, be the first to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, and we'll make sure that you get a copy of the book. We'll also have a link at thericksmithshow.com where you can purchase this fantastic book, which the former governor of Michigan calls a must-read. And I think it is. I think if you want to know where the money's coming from and you want to know how this whole, to me, this whole incestuous pool of right-wing insanity comes from, you got to read the book. But I look at this, and, you know, how do we undo this? Beyond informing, beyond, you know, shining the sunlight on this, is there a way to fight back against this stuff, Lee?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm sorry to say I don't have a ready-made answer for you. You know, for a lot of these groups, you know, I look state by state, and I've compared. You know, it's true that the left tries to mimic some of these right-wing groups by setting up these kind of permanent media research and rapid response think tanks. You know, in Michigan, they've got Progress Michigan. In some of these other states, they've got similar groups. In Wisconsin, I think it's called One Wisconsin. The problem is, you know, they get a little bit of union money and a little bit from the foundation world. But the difference is corporations are seeing a huge return on investment by giving to the right-wing groups. Yep. So we're seeing the think tanks on the right with five or six times the budget of the groups on the left. And just playing their game isn't enough. I think folks need to get creative. They need to look back at history and see that, you know, progressive change has always come from the streets, from unique creative actions. There's this big disparity in terms of money, and that will always be true. And, in fact, it's getting worse. But I think to counter that, folks need to return to the basics and get motivated, engage in activism.
You know, as I've always said, you know, they may have a lot of money, but we've out-procreated them. There are more of us. And, well, I mean, what is. And I look at just, you know, yesterday there was an action in Allentown on education where one mother organized 175, 200 people to go out and protest and have a walkout of an elementary school to protest the austerity cuts to their school district. And I've been saying this is what we need to be doing on so many levels, and to bring back that militancy. And I wish that working people would view education and health care and pensions and wages much like the NRA views the gun issue. I want people to be militant and protect their way of life, and I'm just not seeing it. And it kind of goes hand in hand with what we're talking about here. As the wealth class spends all of this money influencing and dividing our attention, we should be fighting back and saying, you know, enough of that, and knowing that, you know, as the old man told me, when a rich guy spends a buck to tell me I need something, I better spend two not to get it. Just a thought.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I need to look up that protest in Allentown. That sounds really interesting. But there's this dichotomy where, you know, corporations or billionaires are just getting so much more politically activated. You know, it's not just the Facebook types or the Koch brother types. You know, a lot of corporations are financing these right-wing think tanks because they see it as in their economic interest. Yep. To further these ideological groups. When, you know, back in the day, big corporations split their campaign dollars 50-50, Democrats and Republicans, and didn't really engage in these kind of more nasty, you know, battles like going after unions. But that's all changing. You know, a lot of corporate boards, I suppose, are seeing it in their economic interest to go after folks. And it's really just a shame that, you know, this is coming at a time when people are getting stretched economically. You know, that people are trying to make ends meet. They're working two jobs. They're trying to pay off their student debt. They feel like they don't have time for activism. But, you know, time is running out when you have these huge austerity measures that are being put into place that are going to be very difficult to roll back. At least in the short term.
You know, I've often said, you know, to go hearken an old labor saying, you know, when people's stomachs get empty, their heads get right. Is that what it's going to take? I mean, is it going to take that we allow these people to drive us completely off the road and over the cliff and there's nothing left to lose before we wake up and realize that the people we've given so much power to and the people who've pushed these policies, they're the reason that they've done it. And I hearken back to the Powell memos, which most, I'm sure my listeners have read, but most people have never heard of. You know, this game plan, the well-funded corporate game plan of doing exactly where we are now, only it's been 40, 45 years in the making.
Well, that memo came out of a time, you know, that was in 1971. That was coming at a time when Nixon was still feeling the pressure to be progressive, you know, creating OSHA, creating the Clean Air Act. You know, this is a time when the environmental movement was picking up. If you read the Powell memo, I think he mentions Ralph Nader like five times because, you know, Ralph Nader struck the fear of God into him because he's leading all these consumer rights movements. They're making people feel empowered that they have some say in the marketplace. You know, so it was this type of movement that gave birth to, you know, the Paul Weyrich groups, the Heritage Foundation and ALEC and the American Enterprise Institute and the Cato Institute. And, you know, those groups, I think, kind of launched the 30-year period between Reagan and Bush, you know, the supply-side economics, this kind of philosophy that the government, the only purpose of the government is to bail out big corporations and to engage in foreign wars. And, you know, again, Republicans, seeing what Obama could have done in 2009, 2010, they kind of went back to the basics and said, you know, if we don't have power politically, we're going to create this kind of third-party power structure or at least rebuild our political machine that exists outside of the traditional political parties. So that's those think tanks and those training institutes and these propaganda efforts that have kind of put a damper on all those progressive dreams that a lot of people had just 4 years ago.
And now is that, and I know you go into it in the book, is that where the Tea Party came out of?
Yeah, and that's right. You know, the Tea Party, I think, I have a little bit of a different perspective. Actually, when I first started reporting on the Tea Party back in 2009, I came on your show and we talked about this, about the Koch brothers and Dick Armey, a lot of these well-heeled lobbyists churning out the Tea Party, or at least channeling the Tea Party for these very corporate priorities. But, you know, I had a little bit more time to research it. And the book kind of goes through this kind of fascinating history, showing that there were a group of corporate lobbyists and some of the same kind of millionaires and billionaires who were never comfortable with working with the social conservative wing of the Republican Party. So they had always been looking for a populist vanguard that was based in economic principles. So you look back in 1993 when Clinton tried to propose a health care plan that was financed based on an excise tax on tobacco products. Well, Philip Morris, the documents are in the book, Philip Morris says, you know, we can't protest this as Philip Morris. People will hate us. We need a third-party validator. So they you know, release an RFP. They put out these contracts to these PR firms. And these PR firms say, well, we've got an idea. We'll launch a nationwide Tea Party against the excise tax. Your fingerprints won't be on it. And they do that. It just doesn't catch on.
Right.
Fast forward to 1997. Dick Armey and a lot of his billionaire backers, they decide that they want to launch a campaign for the flat tax to replace the progressive income tax. They go to Boston. They throw tea in the harbor. They launch all these kind of fake AstroTurf groups. It just doesn't catch on. We see this over and over again, 2003, 2004, even up to 2007. They're paying out cash grants to activists who will go out and stage Tea Party rallies. It just doesn't catch on. But, you know, with the right circumstances in the beginning of 2009, when there's a lot of populist anger at the financial crisis, they had the time, they had the money, they had the resources, they had the experience that it finally caught on this time. So it's an interesting backstory to how the Tea Party really came to be.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the old Milton Friedman comment that, you know, only a crisis or a perceived crisis produces change, and it's the ideas that are lying around that end up being used. And here again, these things are just lying around. And a fascinating book. Again, it's called The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, written by our friend Lee Fong. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Sorry, I already gave the book away to our first emailer, but you can pick up a copy. Just click on Lee's name. It'll take you right to the site where you can pick it up. Lee, great book. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it. It's always great talking to you.
Thank you so much. Have a nice night.
You
take
too.
Care.
Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.thericksmithshow.com.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, I go back to that whole Tea Party time, and you know, as Lee brought up, you know, it was the big moneyed interests who wanted that, you know, that populist uprising, because, hey, you know, we've been screwed. The working class of this country has been completely, totally screwed by the people who funded this whole thing. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, we've been duped so many times, not even really all that funny anymore, but it is predictable. It is the cycle of things. And I remember at the beginning of the Tea Party, I was one of the first people going, "You're right, I'm ticked off, I'm angry, let's get some heads." And I went to a couple early rallies, talked to a couple people who emerged as the local leaders, and it was all very predictable. It's the government's fault. We need private for-profit corporations to come in and do all of these things for us. And you go, and I remember asking the question, can you show me when that's worked? Can you show me that, you know, when you have a profit motive above all else, where that's been really the benefit? And look, I believe there are some tenets, some portions of capitalism that are important that you have to keep. You have to have incentive and you have to have, you know, those kind of things. But at the end of the day, I don't know that I want that race to the bottom push for profit in everything that society does. You know, do I want people cutting corners who are building our roads and bridges? Do I want to use the cheapest products possible to maximize profit. Do I? No. Do I want the cheapest teacher to stand in front of my children and teach them and teach the next generation to be, you know, the thinkers and the policymakers and the surgeons and the janitors of the future? Do I want that? And the answer is no. Do I want, you know, healthcare professionals who are thinking about the bottom line more than my health? And of course, the answer is no. But when that was going on, I remember, you know, the people involved going, "Wow, we need to destroy government. They're the cause of all these problems." And yes, conservative, pro-business, billionaire-funded government. You're right, absolutely. Now, I had lunch today with a friend who said, "You know, I'm struggling to see the difference between us and the former Soviet Union sometimes. You know, they tell me I have a right to vote, but I never seem to get a choice to vote for anybody because they're both about the same. One's bad, one's less bad." And then they try and throw up roadblocks to try and for me to vote. It's a lot of illusion. They tell me that there's a free market, but you've got all this collusion by these big multinational corporations who they're too big to hold to be accountable. And then when they get in trouble, you and me and our kids, we're the ones who have to pick up the mess. And as I was thinking about that, I came across a story from California, where they're evidently in San Francisco building the proposal of building a billion-dollar project to house the Golden State Warriors of the NBA. $1 billion. To build an arena, to build a basketball court. But it's going to be beautiful. I mean, I looked at the drawings. It's phenomenal. It's on the waterfront. It looks at the Bay Bridge. You see the San Francisco skyline. It's got windows. So while you're supposedly watching the basketball game, you can look out the window. How great is that? And I just sit here scratching my head going, you know, all the false choices that we're given, all the BS that we're given. We couldn't use that $1 billion to fund healthcare and education and infrastructure. We got to put it into an arena that we know is not going to create the jobs that we need. Look, I'm as much for building things as anybody. But don't tell me that this is going to spur economic development, because I look at my hometown, where I grew up in Cleveland. They've got some of the most beautiful sports complexes in the country. Three amazing architectural structures, beautiful, fan-friendly, this and that. But the problem is nobody's got any money to go. And the people who do, well, they sit in the privatized boxes away from the rabble. And is that the America we want? Now, I went to an Indians game a couple years ago, and I remember going, you know, here, this right here, this is the two Americas. There's the us sitting in these seats, you know, and then there's the them sitting above us, looking down on us. I just remember having a very uneasy feeling, and now I see this $1 billion building project. Well, I guess these are our modern-day coliseums, huh? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, hour three of the program. If you missed any portion of our program thus far, the podcast is at therichmithshow.com and, of course, Stitcher on your smartphone. Quick break. Right back.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union Local 8 members are locked out of their jobs at the Port of Portland, Oregon by Columbia Grain. ILWU Local 8 President Bruce Holt says the Japanese-owned company has hired an out-of-state strike-breaking firm, anti-union lawyers, and a publicist to make allegations against local workers. Port of Portland security guards, represented by ILWU Local 28, also say they have been improperly displaced by the lockout. This latest port lockout of West Coast dock workers follows the Port of Vancouver, Washington lockout by Matsui-owned United Grain that started February 27th. United Grain and Columbia Grain are part of an employer bargaining group trying to squeeze dock workers. The ILWU says rather than bargain to reach fair contracts, the employers are locking out their workers. Republican legislative leaders in Ohio said just hours after some Republicans introduced anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation that there's not enough support in the GOP-controlled General Assembly to pass the anti-union bills. Three separate bills proposing anti-union right-to-work policies were introduced on May Day by Republican Representatives Christina Rugner and Ron Magg. In 2011, in a landslide statewide vote, Ohio voters resoundingly repealed the anti-union attack on public worker collective bargaining known as SB 5. Construction workers in Coopersville, Michigan protested the use of non-local workers at the construction site of a state and local subsidized project. Jesse Russell reports.
Fair Oak Farm Brands has contracted Dahlgren Industries to build their $127 million bottling plant. In order to build the plant, the company received state and local grants. A protest held on Friday was intended to bring attention to the company's use of non-local workers and also the firing of two employees, reportedly for expressing interest in joining a union. The protest was led by the West Michigan Plumbers, Pipefitters, and Service Trades Local 174. According to the union, the company has brought in workers from other states, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines for the project. The two pipe fitters fired by the company have filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. The company has responded to the allegations, saying that 90% of the workforce is made up of Michigan residents, and that the workers were terminated for violating safety and work rules.
Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. And while you're there, click on Lee Fong's name and it'll take you right to his book, The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. An absolute, as the former governor of Michigan says, an absolute must read. If you want to see what the Tea Party, how they came about, the ideas, where the money's coming from, you know, where groups like ALEC get their money and you know what they're pushing. And Lee, of course, one of the eight of those dreaded people who will, well, who tell you what they're doing. One of those people not allowed in any of their meetings. The people can come except those eight. And on the line, I've got another one of the eight, Brendan Fisher. He is general counsel for the Center for Media and Democracy, their website, prwatch.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Brendan, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're one, along with Lee, one of the dreaded eight, one of the most wanted on the hit list.
Yeah, we are a real menace to society.
And why are you such a menace? What possibly could you do to upset a group that, well, I mean, has millions and millions of dollars and numerous legislators across the country in their pocket?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just that we've been exposing ALEC for what they are. We've been, since at least July of 2011 when we launched ALECExposed.org, we've been focusing on ALEC and tracking their every move. And, you know, it really hasn't been that hard for us. They've made it pretty easy. We've really just had to expose what ALEC is and how they operate to a wider audience. And they don't like that. They prefer to operate in secrecy. They prefer that the general public doesn't know how they operate. They prefer that they can just have their meetings with legislators and exert their influence behind closed doors. And when people begin to shine a light on them, they get angry and they start to put together mugshots of people like me and like Lee.
Yeah, I look at it and I understand recently there was an American Legislative Exchange Council meeting in Oklahoma City, which, you know, I think of, you know, Oklahoma City is not a den of progressive activism or labor activism, yet we see, from what I'm reading, hundreds of people in the street protesting Alex's presence there.
Yeah, it was really incredible. The AFL-CIO and the Firefighters Union, the IAFF, and a number of different unions, as well as environmentalists, church leaders, all showed up, gave Alec a proper welcome. I think at least 600 people showed up to protest Alec, you know, banging on the windows. The Teamsters, big rigs were driving around the convention center honking their horns. And I think there were only around 500 Alec legislators inside. So the protesters actually outnumbered the Alec members. So that was a pretty incredible response. And myself and Nick Sergi, who is also from the Center for Media and Democracy, where I work, and who is also on the Alec's Most Wanted list, we both went down there to see what kind of information we could gather. And, of course, you know, they didn't want us in their conference. They kicked Nick out immediately. They recognized him. They didn't spot me, but we were able to pick up a few documents. And really, like I mentioned, they make it too easy for us. One of the documents showed Alec instructing state legislators that all of their model bills, all of their meeting agendas should not be subject to a state open records request. Basically, you have Alec telling legislators what should and should be not subject to their state's laws. You also saw the mugshots that you just discussed, that Alec is actually assembling a list of reporters and activists who they think are not going to provide them favorable treatment, so therefore they should be silenced. They should be allowed nowhere near the Alec meeting.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Constitution says, right? Right? I mean, you press people are such a pain in the neck because, well, you'll write about it.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, and what makes it even funnier is that Alec handed out this set of talking points to legislators. So they had a number of different talking points providing a really sanitized version to legislators about why they would be attending the Alec conference, how they can talk to press, and then if anyone asked about the protesters, legislators were supposed to say that we support the First Amendment, we support the right to free assembly, but, you know, we ask that blank, fill in the blank, whoever the protesters are, respect our right to assemble as well. But, of course, they really didn't respect the right to free assembly. There was a counter Alec movie screening and panel and community forum. So there's a screening of the United States of Alec documentary, which was done by Bill Moyers earlier this year or late last year. And that was supposed to take place in the same convention center where the Alec meeting was scheduled. They reserved the room months in advance, and then less than 24 hours before the event was to take place, Alec instructed the convention center to give the community forum the boot, to tell the people that they cannot assemble freely, that you are a threat to Alec, you are a threat to our corporate sponsors. Your basic desire to, you know, get people together and talk about these issues is basically raining on our parade. You're interfering with our party. So they kicked them into the basement. The event went on nonetheless. A few hundred people showed up. It was really well received. So, you know, Alec couldn't crush that, but they definitely tried. And then, of course, you know, the First Amendment also protects the freedom of the press. And if you respect the freedom of the press, you don't create these dossiers on disfavored reporters, and you don't kick reporters out of your conference.
Right, but
even the reporters that they do like, they don't let them into the task force meetings where model bills are discussed.
But what do you say to the argument that, say, look, the Constitution, that whole Bill of Rights, that's just between you and your government. It has nothing to do with us, the for-profit private entity, or the private entity that has is not a government agency, that you don't, the press doesn't have a right to deal with us.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is true that the First Amendment does relate to a government's interaction with people, but the concept of free assembly and free press and free speech is something that Alec is claiming to strongly support. But beyond that, I mean, Alec almost presents itself as this quasi-governmental organization. They are developing legislation. They're doing it behind closed doors. In some states, legislators are asserting exemptions to the open records law, this draft exemption under the open records law. They're treating their correspondence and interactions with Alec as if it's part of a legislative drafting process. So they're acting in many ways as if they are a governmental organization. They're acting as if they're an above the board legislative educational group, but they certainly aren't acting like that. They're certainly not accountable to any people. All they're really accountable to are the corporations that fund them.
You know, what's interesting to me is, you know, you said there were 500 legislators there, and I guess my question is, do we know who these legislators are? I mean, is there a record of, you know, who in each state, how many legislators in the Pennsylvania General Assembly were at this meeting or go to these ALEC conferences? And can't we go, hey, you know, we know you picked up all this stuff. We want to see it. You're our legislator. You're on our dime. You work for us.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're there in their official capacity. They're there in their role as a legislator, you know, officially representing their constituents, officially representing the people of their state. So the people of their state should be able to know what they were doing, what was in those meeting agendas, and at the very least, who attended. And we've been working on this. It's really been like pulling teeth. So we did a whole round of open records requests in the run-up to the meeting, because typically Alec shares his meeting agendas and model bills prior to the meeting. In the past, we've been able to get a lot of information in the run-up to the meeting through open records requests. But this time around, perhaps because Alec is telling legislators that its documents are not subject to open records requests, we haven't gotten anything. So we have very little information about what actually happened in that meeting through open records requests. We were able to gather a little bit when we were there, but it's something we're still working on. And it's really absurd, and I think it really further shows how Alec prefers to operate in secret and how people just shouldn't stand for it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But, you know, recently when you guys exposed them, and I think you guys have done an outstanding job with the Alec Exposed website, and I think you guys are doing fantastic work on this. I saw that they basically dumped everything. They had a massive document drop. And I said at the time, this is that diversion. This is, here, go look at all this garbage that we've been talking about for years. And we've got a whole nother agenda that we're working on. And we're going to put out these, I think it was like, what, 150 pieces of model legislation, that they had pimped in the past that they had just dumped out there.
Yeah, it was really a PR move more than anything else. At the point that they published their model bills online, we had already put over 900 model bills on our website, alecexposed.org. So them posting some of their bills was a redundancy at best. But what makes it even worse is that they tried to cover their tracks. They tried to get rid of the bills that were really offensive, like the Stand Your Ground law, that initially attracted a lot of attention to them, as well as some of the prison privatization laws or the tough on crime laws that they became known for, or Arizona's SB 1070, the anti-immigrant law. So they're trying to disavow their role in pushing these laws around the country. But, you know, they can change their mind about it, and they can try and spin it as if they have nothing to do with them. But the fact is that they pushed these laws for years. And the laws are on the books in multiple states, in many cases in a majority of states, and they're doing nothing to try and repeal those laws. So, you know, they can say all they want about this particular bill no longer being an official ALEC model, but the problem is that the damage is already done. The laws are on the books, and if they're not working to repeal those laws, then, you know, this is nothing more than window dressing. their effort to try and spin themselves as transparent is very shallow.
Yeah, you know, but I look at this, and again, you know, it's another one of these front groups, and I guess the last question I've got for you is, you know, who's funding this? Where does or do we know who's giving the marching orders here?
Yeah, you know, it varies every meeting, and over the past year, 44 major corporations have dropped their ALEC membership, including Coca-Cola, Walmart, Amazon. But there's a number of major corporations that have still kept their ALEC membership, and I'm not certain that they're ever going to drop it. So this is like Reynolds American Tobacco was the top sponsor of this last ALEC meeting, followed by Koch Industries, which is probably no surprise, as well as a number of the oil companies, Chevron, including in TransCanada, which is the group that's trying to push the Keystone XL pipeline.
Right.
And then a number of different insurance companies. So all of these corporations are paying ALEC membership, paying to sponsor these ALEC meetings because they have an agenda to advance. They're spending the tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars to join ALEC and access these state legislators because they're getting something out of it. So they wouldn't keep going back to ALEC if they weren't getting something in return, and the evidence really suggests that they are getting it.
Yeah. Again, you look at this, and you know, I guess the sales point for these big companies go, look, we've got all these 500 legislators in our pocket carrying our water. Give us money, and it's just to me, it is exactly what it is.
yeah. It's certainly anti-democratic. It's certainly not the way that government is supposed to work. You expect your elected officials to be working on your behalf, to be primarily responsive to their constituents, but what we're seeing with ALEC, what we're seeing in the sort of money-dominated post-Citizens United election world is that elected officials more and more often are acting on behalf of these big corporate interests. They're paying little attention to the average people, to the working people in their state or in their district, and they're spending very little time with them. They're spending a lot of time with big corporate donors and with corporate lobbyists, at ALEC meetings, at big fundraisers, and their policy positions are tracking those of the people who fund their campaigns and those of the people who are attending these ALEC meetings, taking them out to dinner, taking them out to drinks, taking them to parties. And, you know, government is becoming more and more responsive and more in line with these corporate interests rather than those of working people and average Americans.
And the sad thing is, you know, I've talked to people over the years who I thought got into public service for the right reasons, and you know, the allure of those things seems to have pulled them into this cesspool. And I'm not sure, other than getting the money out of it, what direction we go from here.
Yeah, I mean, I think public pressure can do a lot. I mean, especially if they got into it for the right reasons, I think it's easy to get lured into sort of the corporate trap or the money trap. But the public pressure is really what's going to make the difference. And making your elected officials know that you disapprove of their ALEC membership, or you disapprove of their being so cozy with these special interests, and you still have your power at the ballot box, and if enough people contact the legislators and express their preferences and remain engaged, you know, I think that great things can happen.
I'm with you. And to go to a website like yours, alecexposed.org, also prwatch.org. We've got links at therickSmithShow.com. Brendan Fisher, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Center of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Sometimes corporate greed flares with such intensity that it ignites public outrage. This happened in April when an 8-story, recklessly built clothing factory in Dhaka, Bangladesh, crashed. Hundreds of workers were crushed by slabs of concrete, having been ordered by the ruthless factory owner to continue working, even though the structure's collapse was imminent. Public rage at such scorn for the value of workers' lives led to mass protests across the country and the jailing of the owner. Good. But what about his equally culpable cohorts? The CEOs of Walmart, Gap, and other retailing behemoths who've instilled this culture of greed throughout their global supply chain. They've dictated a corporate order that compels shortcuts on safety and rewards unscrupulous factory owners. Walmart and other major clothing marketers surged into Bangladesh in recent years specifically because it has the world's cheapest, least protected laborers. Corporate bosses know that Bangladeshi factories are hell holes where nightmares constantly come true. Less than 6 months ago, a horrific fire in another factory in this same city killed 112 workers who were making clothing for these same giants. Walmart subsequently responded by pledging zero tolerance for such haphazard manufacturing, loudly launching a $1.6 million worker safety academy in Bangladesh, and blah, blah, blah. It was pure, disgraceful PR bull stuff, and it changed nothing. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, Walmart refuses to sign a legally binding fire and building safety agreement put forth by labor advocates. It would require the profiteers to make all their factories safe, open each one to independent inspectors, and stop their senseless tolerance for the serial killing of garment workers. For information on this agreement, go to workersrights.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
What about the Rick Smith Show? Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. All those greedy, lazy, those public servants, those greedy, lazy people. You know, those mailmen, those lazy people. Greedy, lazy, pension-sucking, no goods. Isn't that what they tell us? Interesting story from the New Hampshire Sunday News. I'll read it directly from the article. Several people, including a mailman, ran into a burning building on Merrimack Street on Saturday, looking for residents feared trapped in a fire, authorities said. Two people were treated at the scene for smoke inhalation, including postal worker Tom Sapenza. Tom, after being treated, you know, the postal worker, the lazy postal worker, who I hope you didn't miss the Saturday part, he returned to his postal truck saying he wasn't allowed to talk to the reporters, but wasn't planning on going home right away, saying, I have to get back to my route. Spokesman for the Postal Service, a guy named Tom Rizzo, who is the spokesperson for the for Northern New England, said the letter carriers, they come across the country to help people in a variety of ways each year. Also saying that Tom had been a postal worker since 2007 and will most definitely not be getting in trouble for any mail getting delivered later than normal on Saturday. Not gonna get in trouble for going and trying to save people's lives. A couple of things pop out at me. Saturday delivery being one of them. What if this was a Saturday when there is no delivery? No postal worker to run it. And again, you go back to this whole idea of public servants. The guy ran into a building looking for people in a fire build, a building on fire, and then goes back to work. Does his job. These are the lazy and shiftless people the right want us to believe are ruining our country. And it's because of them that things are going bad and they're ruining everything. If we could just get them to work for pennies. And be more flexible. Yeah, that was a great theme in the 2012 election that most working people didn't catch. Romney going running around saying, well, we need business to be more flexible. We need those workers to be more flexible, which is why we're seeing the Working Families Flexibility Act of 2013, which I guess today there was to be a vote in the House of Representatives on. Because, you know, businesses just need more flexibility. That's all. That's all. They just need more flexibility. That's it. What I love about it is in the name, it makes you think that, hey, we're going to have some flexibility. But when you look at the language and you look at what the real world implications are going to be, there's no flexibility for you workers. In fact, you know, you go back to when they proposed this back on the government level. Because I think it was, you know, back in the mid-80s where, you know, the public sector workers were saddled with this and their contractors. And it wasn't about giving workers flexibility. And as Alan Sykes-Wald, somebody we've had on the program a couple of times, writes over at Salon, points out, the move was purely a way to cut costs for government, not provide workers with more freedom. It was something that they tried to ram, that they actually rammed down the throats of the unions to cut costs. It had nothing to do with flexibility. But now, I guess the reason I'm mentioning this is because look at how far the bar has shifted. Now we're doing the exact same thing, but saying that, you know, we're giving you the flexibility. You can have it. Comp time. You know, you could take time off to be with your family. Yet I don't see that in the rules. I see it that, you know, the company is going to get what they want out of it, which is you working longer hours during high demand times. And then when things are slower, you going to the curb. And I'm saying, oh, well, here, we're going to screw you out of overtime pay. And it's a destruction, in my view, of the Fair Labor Standards Act. But again, in Orwellian world, where we seem to find ourselves in the rabbit hole where everything's backwards and upside down, you look at this Martha Roby, who's a Republican from Alabama, who was on a serious radio program recently and said that, you know, hey, you know, things are going to be okay because workers are going to be protected because of the current, the already existing, you know, that Fair Labor Standards Act, they'll be protected against coercions under that. All of the protections against the Fair Labor Standards, they exist. They'll be in this bill. It'll be sure that employers will never be able to take advantage of employees. No, never. And when does that happen? When does that ever happen? When does it ever happen that an employer cheats employees out of wages? When does that ever happen? There was a court case recently filed that between 2000 and 2011, there had been an increase of violations of wage and hour laws of about 400%. But, you know, don't worry about that. And then there was that 2009 survey that was done that said that, you know, two-thirds of low-income workers had experienced a wage violation in the last 2 weeks. But, you know, don't worry about that. The current laws are in place. And I think about our friend Ike, who we haven't heard from in some time, who, you know, the employer basically stole several weeks' pay from him. But hey, the labor laws are in place. Don't worry about it. All that's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Let me tell you exactly. bottom line, flat line, end of story. This is it. This is the, this is when you hear the Orwellian Republicans saying, we're for the Working Families Flexibility Act. What is it? Bottom line, it's theft. It's a destruction of the 40-hour work week. It is undoing what generations have fought, bled, and died for. It is undoing that overtime provision and saying that, hey, you know what, we can work you 60, 80 hours in a week, and, well, we'll give it to you sometime in the year when really we decide. And I know the Robies of the world are saying, no, it's an agreement between the employer and the employee because we believe in this concept that Rand Paul has revived of liberty of contract. Bring back Lochner. Because, of course, you and your employer are on equal footing, right? You have equal say, right? Right? No. But they want you to believe that you do. And, you know, I have a friend who's an attorney who says, you know, go and read the workers' comp statute where it talks about master and servant. Because in the eyes of the law, it's still viewed as a master-servant relationship. So if you work for somebody, you are their servant. They are your master. And, you know, I think this recession has shown a lot of people, or should have shown a lot of us, that, you know, once you lose that position, once that employer kicks you to the curb, your life changes. And in some really pretty serious ways. You know, I think of the number of people who have lost their homes because, you know, hey, they thought they were going to have a job forever. They thought, hey, this is where I'm going to retire from. And what happened? Well, to the curb. So I look at this and I go back to this idea that there are laws in place and this misconception that there are laws that we can reach to. They're not there. Some of the few things that are, we're seeing, well, them wanting to destroy. The other point in this that as I've been reading it, it gives workers the right to sue. But as I understand, you can't go through the Department of Labor, which is curious to me. Why would, when we have a mechanism to make sure that workers are treated fairly, to go through the Department of Labor, the National Labor Relations Board, all of that stuff, why would they say you have the right to sue? Well, because they know that it's much, much more costly for an individual worker. And I use Ike's story, you know, and I'll probably never forget, you know, the phone call where he said, look, I had to sell my stove to put gas in the tank. You know, I don't have the money. They stole from me and there's nobody who's willing to help. There's no government agency in South Carolina willing to help him. So why would they say, oh, you can go get a lawyer? Well, for a couple $100 or $1,000 or whatever it is, are you really going to be able to go out and afford a $5,000 lawyer to fight a $1,000 claim? Of course not. And they know that. So they're setting up a scenario where saying, oh, you have these rights, but hey, you got to go sue for it. Good luck. And then they're defunding at an alarming rate the Department of Labor, and they've neutered the National Labor Relations Board by not allowing any of the nominees to be appointed and confirmed. So you end up with this scenario where you've got all of the power in the hands of the masters. Think about that. Think about the fact that, you know, as I've said, you know, in just a 10-year period, wage theft claims gone up over 400%. Two-thirds of the people surveyed in this 2009 survey had experienced a wage law violation in the previous week. Think about that. And now bring this to, well, you know, it's a contract between you and your employer. You can easily agree to it. Yeah, that's like saying, I've got a gun to my head, and I'm not going to agree with the guy holding the gun. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
We got to get
listening to the Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Well, I guess now the news has broken that Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, went and had his stomach banded. And hey, you know, my take is good for him, you know, but the message I take from it, he's in. 2016, he's going to be going for it. That's the only thing I can really come up with. He said, look, you know, I'm pushing 50 and I'm really morbidly obese and I probably wanted to be around a 51, which hey, whatever you got to do. My question then becomes, since Christie has, you know, the personal responsibility party, the people who point their finger and go, "Ah, you should take responsibility for yourself." How are they going to spin this gastric banding? Just a thought. And my other question is this something that the state of New Jersey paid for? Did the good citizens of New Jersey pay for it? And if they did, shouldn't that be something that's available to everybody else? And will it be part of Obamacare? Another question. Just more thought, 2016 around the corner. Can't wait. Oh, boy. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I've got Justin Duck on Talk Radio News Service. Justin, what do you think? Gastric banding?
Well, actually, you know, I've been around Chris Christie. I guess I have been around him both in the before and the after pictures of him. About a year and a half ago, I was, perched behind him for about an hour and a half during a speech that the president gave to the National Governors Association. And I actually saw him about 2 weeks ago at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So, if he did lose 40 pounds, I guess I could have actually been able to tell that. He's still a very, large dude, as am I guess. But, it looks like it has been working for him. I haven't really seen anybody come out and say that he used government funds on it. As far as we know, he actually checked into the hospital under a fake name to get it done. The personal responsibility argument still stands. But, beyond anything like that, it doesn't look necessarily very scandalous. But I have been looking all day for a quote that he apparently made a few years ago that I remember in the back of my head saying, if I ever lose 100 pounds or if I ever, do something like that, then that means I'm running for president. But, I can't quite track it down, but if you can, you're a better man than I.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, at the end of it, to me, that's what came of it for me. And maybe the health thing, maybe the doctor said, hey, you've got to do something, or your heart's going to explode, something. And look, I have no qualms with the guy doing it. But I do believe that there's that whole right wing, that whole conservative where you take responsibility for yourself and all of that stuff that comes with it. That whole you can't control yourself stuff. Maybe this is going to be the maybe he'll be the Jason Collins for fat people. Maybe he'll be the guy who'll be. Hey, you've got a problem because I've struggled with my weight for years.
No, that's true, but he's not the first fat politician though. We've had Taft. We've had Theodore Roosevelt to a certain extent. We had Clinton gaining weight in office. So having a fat politician in America is not anything really new. I guess the main
But for me, though,
this is such a big deal is considering the,
the procedure, man. It's going and having the fat surgery. To me, that's a big thing.
No, it certainly is. That's very true.
And admitting it. So the question then becomes is, will he have, and I guess, in voting for a president, are you going to have a guy who's got the Roker syndrome? Because if you remember the story about Al Roker, I forget
God.
Where he was.
That's a terrible visual.
He was it was during a White House visit and, had to go and just went right in his drawers.
You know, I now can foresee that every public appearance we have with Chris Christie, we're going to be waiting for that moment. So thank you for adding that to my list of responsibilities.
Oh, the Mr. Hanky alert, huh? Oh, let's find out what's going on around town. So what's going on in D.C.? I see the report released on the number of sexual assaults through the roof now, huh?
Well, it looks like, yeah. The number of reported sexual assault incidents in the military has increased by about 35% from 2010 to 2012. We had Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel come out today, and he said personally he hopes that this is solely because there are more people who are now willing to report sexual assault, and that maybe they have done something to dampen the stigma of it. But, of course, you can't be sure, and it certainly doesn't help when you have such high-profile cases going on, particularly with the Air Force officer who was specifically in charge of ensuring that sexual assault did not occur within the military, being arrested in the parking lot in Arlington for allegedly, groping a woman before having the police call on him. So, nobody knows for sure, but we have seen the president come out today and say that he is, not going to be tolerating this, that he expects to see consequences and something stronger than just another call for either additional training or another review board or whatnot. And we also had Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel coming out and saying that this is going to be one of his top priorities and that he is going to strive for a culture where, one, sexual assault does not exist, and two, if it does, people are comfortable reporting it. So that's where we stand on that front today.
Yeah, I was reading through the report, and the numbers that they think are going on are just through the just astronomical. And you go, I understand it's a large organization and there are a lot of people, but when you're talking tens of thousands of incidents a year, there's a serious problem there.
Well, just the very fact that you have such a high profile figure who's in charge of negating this, being arrested for it, that is, that's just symbol for some kind of schism in the culture that has not yet been reprimanded by the efforts to reform this practice.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes in the coming. If it's just something that we get a little lip service from it, and then they hope it goes away. I guess there could be some reality that people are feeling a little more comfortable, a little more angry, and coming out that just what's going on is being reported more often. Kind of like the stories of child abduction and that stuff, where statistically over time the numbers have actually gone down, but the number of high profile cases seem to be ever constant.
No, it's very, very true. And, we've seen incidents of, I guess another good example is hacking against U.S. military facilities. There was a recent report that showed there was a huge uptick in that, but really we haven't really had the, sources to detect when the hack was occurring until pretty recently. And a lot of people just, didn't realize that this was an ongoing threat that had been going on for years and that we were just, so behind in that term of cyber warfare to not be in a position to protect ourselves. So, studies are odd things, but nevertheless, there are some high-profile issues, and at the very least, that's not a good image to have for your military branch.
And here again, for me, the solution to this is the guy who was caught groping in the parking lot, whose job it was to make sure that groping in the parking lot didn't happen. Maybe we send him to a place where he's groped constantly.
That's what it looks like may happen. He's already been suspended. And I'm sure this is going to be a pretty high-profile trial.
Okay, and let's go to Syria. What's going on in Syria now?
Well, we had the president come out today and say that he is not willing to rally an international coalition in the absence of definitive proof that the Syrian regime used chemical weapons. He actually took it a step further and compared that to the reasoning before going into Iraq, saying the U.S. has previously try to rally the world behind something without having further or without having definitive proof. And that did not work out very well then. So it seems that the administration is, very reluctant to follow in the footsteps of the former president, which I guess on one hand is prudent, even though there is a definitive massacre going on.
Yeah. For me, so you're not going to see John Kerry going to the UN with cartoon drawings and saying, we know they have mobile chemical labs and here are cartoon drawings to prove it?
No, it doesn't look like that's going to be happening, but he is nevertheless playing a large role in this. He is in Moscow this week holding a discussion with Russian officials in an attempt to persuade them to drop their support for the Assad regime. Nobody really knows if this is going to be successful or not, but there is some rumblings that he may be more successful than the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. You know, on one hand, there's sort of the cynical sexist side of that, and there's also the view, of course, that he is somebody who has served on the Armed Services Committee, or sorry, on the Foreign Services Committee for so long, and may have a better rapport with a lot of these, you know, Russian officials than you know, Hillary Clinton ever ever struck up.
Yeah, in your view, I've seen a lot of stories today coming out that you know, Mitt Romney was right. Russia is our number one geopolitical foe. And is this, you know, kind of saying, yeah, he was right, or is this just the most expedient way to get to Assad in Syria?
No, that's anybody who makes that argument is, you know, definitely stretching. This is not the sign of a major geopolitical foe. Of course, Syria is not a major geopolitical foe for the U.S. This is an international problem, and the fact that we have a world superpower who takes a different approach to this kind of localized situation, I guess, is not necessarily very surprising. And, you know, this is not a situation to say that Romney is right.
All right, good. So let's go to some hearings tomorrow. I guess hearings on Benghazi tomorrow. Will the smoking gun, I guess there are going to be three whistleblowers coming out, smoking gun. What do you think?
There are. There's, you know, Gregory Hicks, who was a deputy for Christopher Stevens, who was the murdered U.S. ambassador in Libya. He has been going out and saying that apparently there was a request for more special ops troops, and in fact that could have gone in, even though there are a number of military analysts who have since then sort of raised eyebrows, saying that this is sort of just a fantasy, and that even if they were sent in or whatnot, it would not have really prevented the, you know, American personnel from being killed. But nevertheless, this is going to be something that's going to gain a lot of attention. And if you really want to ask whether or not this is something that's worthwhile or just politics, the fact that there has been a, you know, considerable effort to rebrand this from being Obama's mistake before the election to now being Hillary Clinton's mistake, since she's, you know, rumored to be considering a 2016 run, is just evidence of exactly how far this has gone into the realm of politics.
Yeah, for me, I haven't heard anything. I really haven't. I mean, you're in D.C. there. You're closer to this. But I haven't heard anything how we make sure that this doesn't happen again. I mean, have we done any beefing up? Have we put any additional resources into making sure it doesn't happen anywhere else in the world? I don't think so. Or am I wrong?
You know, we have. I don't have the exact numbers. I just know a few people in the State Department who I've spoken with in kind of, I guess, off-the-record conversations. And they have told me that, you know, this is something that has been looked at right now, and there are additional personnel who are now looking at the safety for embassies. But in terms of any huge significant changes that would really make headlines, it doesn't seem like there's anything that's been done.
I mean, because for me, all of this comes back down to all of the austerity and the funding cuts over the years that have really cut their budget as well. And for me, I say, you know, this is a systematic problem beyond just appointing resources. This is a problem of resources throughout our government, the strangleholding, the Grover Norquist, I want things small enough to drown it in the bathtub. And when you drown things in the bathtub, to me, this is the kind of things you end up with.
No, certainly true. You know, it's always, it makes sense to cut money from the State Department until you have something like this pop up. And we, of course, you know, saw a number of Republican lawmakers who were really vocal on this issue be caught with the, you know, egg on their face, particularly Jason Chaffetz from Utah.
So let me ask you last questions I've got for you, the immigration reform stuff coming around. Is Marco Rubio, is he Schumer's water boy?
I wouldn't go so far to call him that, but there is sort of a conservative revolt going on right now, or maybe not a revolt, at least a schism. We saw the Heritage Foundation, which is, of course, headed by Senator Jim DeMint, who, when he was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was really against any sort of common sense foreign policy approach for anything ever. You know, that report stated that immigration reform was going to cost the country upwards of $6.3 trillion. And we are now seeing numbers like Grover Norquist coming out and saying that these numbers are grossly inflated, saying that it does not take into account those who are already citizens in the U.S. and therefore is inflating the price by about 40%. We saw, you know, Marco Rubio also take sort of a approach to that, saying the, you know, people who the report really attacked are Americans who are living here right now and would really constitute, you know, people that Americans already know and relatives of, you know, legal citizens living within the U.S.
For me, this is an interesting divide because you're seeing the conservatives and the extremists in the Republican Party kind of at odds, because I think the party knows that in order for them to remain a party of any significance, they're going to have to attract Hispanic voters, because you just look at demographics, if nothing else. They've got to figure out a way to reach out to them. And you've got that extremist wing of the party who's saying, no, we want to remain male, stale, and pale.
No, certainly true. There are people who are trying to appease that, and they definitely are latching onto the Heritage Report, even though it doesn't necessarily look like it's actually, true.
And as I understand, in looking at the reports that that Heritage has put out in the past, it even conflicts with its own reports in pretty stark terms.
No, it certainly does. And, it's worth noting that this is essentially an old report that was written by a single person and, really does not contain any of the major demographic shifts that we've seen in recent years. So it's not surprising that this conflicts with a lot of the things that they have reported on in the past.
Yay. All right. Well, good stuff. But I found it interesting. Marco Rubio, the Chuck Schumer's water boy, one of the most extreme guys, in my view, in the Senate as Schumer's water boy. I found that comical.
That is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, Justin, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
In a part of the ocean known as the North Pacific Gyre, plastic waste has increased 100-fold over the past 40 years, according to a new study.
This is the infamous Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's not an actual floating island of garbage, but it is a part of the Pacific filled with floating bits of plastic, often fingernail-sized, mostly from the U.S. West Coast and East Coast of Asia.
Miriam Goldstein of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego led the new study. It indicates that the plastic in the North Pacific Gyre has provided new habitats for some marine creatures. Which sea creatures are being affected? One is the marine insect known as the sea skater or water strider. They're related to the water skaters you might have seen on the surfaces of freshwater ponds.
Marine sea skaters live on the ocean's surface. They lay their eggs on floating objects such as seashells, seabird feathers, tar lumps, and pumice, and now plastic garbage, according to Goldstein's study.
The increase in plastics for skater habitats could result in more marine sea skaters. This in turn can create a subtle shift in the ocean food web. Goldstein's study was published in the journal Biology Letters.
For more, come to earthsky.org and search for Pacific Plastic. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. I'll get this strap on the smartphone, take the program on the go. Sad news for those who are following the race in South Carolina for the first congressional district down there. Mr. Appalachian Trail has won. Stephen Colbert's sister, not so good. To me, I'm kind of amazed that people thought she had a chance. I mean, this is one of the more conservative districts in the country. The interesting part of it is you got people who came out to vote, and they voted for that guy, which is kind of funny. Now, the question becomes, what happens day after tomorrow when he goes to court for the trespassing and all of the stuff that's gone on around entering his ex-wife's house? I guess that didn't play into. I guess what did play into the whole thing is, down in South Carolina, they've really done a masterful job, the wealth class, of saying, you know, it's those workers. It's those unions. They're the ones. And she, that, you know, Colbert Bush, she's the union's candidate. And I had to laugh at the number of times I saw that pop up. And the ads that Sanford ran, which were really just lies. But what do you expect? So I'm kind of interested to see what the responses tomorrow will be. And will the Republicans open Mr. Appalachian Trail with open arms? And, you know, today he was on with, I think it was Morning Joe, where the one woman had asked him about, you know, what do you tell people about, you know, the mistakes you've made? You know, can they trust you? And he basically said, well, could we trust you? And I found it fairly interesting that Scarborough, a Republican, a former Republican legislator, went back after him and said, well, what about somebody who does something wrong all the time? Doesn't it say something about their character? And I look at Sanford and you go, you know, there's been a lot of this stuff. I try not to throw judgments at people of things that, you know, I may or may not have done myself, unless it's a habitual thing. And, you know, bad decision after bad decision, what are you going to do when you get into office? So it's going to be interesting. I mean, you know, he was the congressman from that district, so he had a huge advantage. It was a relatively close race, as close as it could have been in that district. But at the end of the day, I'm still one waiting to see what happens on the 9th with the court proceedings. And now that you've got this split going on, this division in the Republican ranks, you know, how do they respond to him? Somebody who was at one point viewed as a national contender, you know, a VP choice perhaps, then the meteoric fall, the whole conservative thing, caught with another woman down in Argentina, which I didn't know the Appalachian Trail went all the way to Argentina. Evidently it does. But I'm interested to see where this stuff goes and how he'll be received by the Republicans. And will he jump on board with their agenda? And I loved the Working Families Flexibility Act. And don't forget the other one, my other favorite, Helping Sick Americans Now Act. At a time when, you know, they're still talking about repealing the health care law. I don't know. You know, when are we going to wake up? When are we going to say enough is enough already? What will it take? Yeah, I'm watching the outrage in the Senate hearing over these assaults. And we talked a little bit about the report that was released by the Defense Department titled Sexual Assault Prevention and Response. It found a 6% rise in the number of assaults being reported over last year. And they estimate that there were 26,000 sexual assaults in the military last year. And you go, you know, how is it that you end up having a guy being the head of that, who he himself now accused of doing the same thing? And you kind of got to wonder about the culture. And this is going to be a growing pain for the military because, you know, how much of it's going to be, real, how much it's going to be cry wolf, and how much it is just, you know, the culture of how things have always been. And maybe the reporting is going, and as Justin said, maybe it's part of the people are feeling more comfortable coming out, or maybe it's just that bad. I think it's that culture of war. I think when you have those kind of scenarios, I think things, laws and rules get a little easier, I think. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therichsmithshow.com. See you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous raid. Democracy is coming.